Tonight on The Download, Department of Cultural Affairs Commissioner Mark Kelly, Chicago actors and musicians David Kadesky and Naomi Ashley, and we reload the news with Craig Newman and A.D. Quigg. Now, here's your host, a man who ran out of breath taking down his Halloween decorations, Justin Kaufman.
It's all these spider webs. You know, let's just they collect all the leaves and you're trying to get them off the window. And it's just, it was a lot. It was hard. The inflatable spider. Oh, so much. No, but I had to get them down today, right? Because it's supposed to rain this weekend. And there's nothing worse than taking down Halloween decorations in the rain in November. It was tough. You know, there were a couple people that walked past while I was doing it and kind of gave a smile, snicker. And I'm like, you know what? That's reserved for pre-Halloween. Post-Halloween, hey. Like, there were some kids that were out there that were like, oh, this, look at the, oh. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story. There's a preschool right near where I live. And as my friend Tommy once was sitting out front, he got to see it firsthand. They walked the kids by with leashes. They leash them together because they're all 2 or 3 years old. So they walk through the city and they're like little puppies. And they just, it's really funny to watch and it's startling if you've never seen it before. This is my friend Tommy's out from out of town. He sees, he's like, what is happening? Am I in the Twilight Zone? And they walked by as I was deflating we had this inflatable spider that kind of climbed out of a window for our Halloween. And I was deflating it. Like, it was the moment I, like, ripped the duct tape off, and the thing just, like, and one of the kids goes, "The spider! Something a spider!"
Oh, no.
And I'm like, and I at first I was like, that same thing. Oh, no. But then I also, like, it overwhelmed with, hey, it's November 3rd.
It's time.
It's time, kid. Learn a lesson about Halloween. I want to be the one that gives you a hard lesson about life. But the hard lesson is, this is appropriate a day or two after.
Yeah.
Then I start telling them about taxes and I don't want to catch you smoking underneath the overpass. No. It's a download. Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up. Commissioner Mark Kelly from the Department of Cultural Affairs is going to stop by in the 7:30 segment, talk about the year of public art, which we talked about on the show, but we're going to talk about the public art plan that the mayor just announced last week, and also the new initiative that the mayor announced this week, that 2018 will be designated the Year of Creative Youth. And if you're a fan of this show, you know how much I've been talking about. Every time we have a young artist from Chicago that's on the show, they'll talk about how they met down at After School Matters downtown at the Cultural Center at the Harold Washington Library. And I always bring it up that's a storyline or a narrative that the city doesn't embrace. You should be talking more about how you foster the CPS, Chicago Public Schools, and the after-school programs. They foster creativity to some of the tastemakers that are changing pop culture as we know it right now. Well, they listened. Maybe the mayor's listening to the download, because 2018, the Year of the Creative Youth, and this will be not only a celebration of the organizations that help foster this creativity, but a big fall festival. So we'll talk about that coming up in the 7:30 segment. Tonight, we'll reload this week's news. This is going to be a great one. I always like this segment. This is one of my favorites because listeners get to call in and text in, and we got great journalists in to talk. And a lot of times you'll get, when you do a week in review, especially when it's a big news story, it's good because you want to talk about the effect of that story, but it also dominates. One of the fun things I like about reloading the news is that their categories, biggest, winners, losers, overreported, underreported. And my favorite is when there's diversity, that we don't really know what the biggest story of the week was. And this week falls right into that category. Can you imagine? You remember what Monday? Monday was the indictment of Paul Manafort. That was Monday. Then you've got the introduction on Thursday of the new tax reform. You've got the closing of DNA Info, which also happened yesterday afternoon. There's so many different stories that happened from this week that it's hard to pick one, but we're going to do that. And then we're going to get your help, too. This is going to be a little bit more of a multiple choice week. 312-981-7200, 80 Quig, and Craig Newman will be in studio. Looking forward to having those guys in. 80 from Daily Line. Craig used to be managing editor over at the Chicago Sun-Times. We'll talk about biggest stories, winners, losers, over-reported, under-reported, which story took you down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years from this year, this week. So we'll talk about that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Later in the show, David Kadesky is going to be here. David's been on the show a couple times, but he's got a great show where he is essentially, he's going to be at Davenport's and he's remounting his show. It's a great, it's True Life Tales. It's a great show where he recounts his childhood memories of growing up in Niagara Falls. And some of those stories are actually true. As any good cabaret show. So David and Naomi Ashley will be in, perform a little bit, and also talk about the show, The Remount. Also, the Canadian duo, Partner is the band. I should say the partnership, that is Partner. Indie Rockers Partner just came through Chicago. We'll talk with them. They were just named by Stereo Gum to be one of the bands to watch here in 2017-2018. Partner getting a lot of great accolades, reviews, and they will be in studio tonight. And then our old buddy Sandy Marshall. Sandy's been on the show many times. He is actually doing social media for NASA this week. Not a bit. Yeah, it's real. Like he's down in at NASA, and he's learning all about satellites and lasers as they introduce the new fleet of satellites and lasers.
Like the real NASA.
Real NASA. Not fake NASA.
Like the National Association of Sewing.
Yeah. No, it's not that. This is real NASA.
Wow.
And I guess this is the thing. I'll ask him about it, but he's been telling me about it, and I thought it was interesting that I guess at a certain point they're always looking for people to come and sort of be social media ambassadors for the projects and
really?
Things that they're launching, whether it be a space launch is the big one, you know, if you want to watch a rocket get launched. But then they also do these other things around satellites or, and in this case, lasers,
wow.
You know, and they'll do stuff. So Sandy's down at NASA and he'll join us in the 10 o'clock hour. So we got a full show tonight.
That is great.
So let's get to it. News, weather, and traffic. Rob Martier and Roger Badish. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's go ahead and carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. The world is aghast at the revelations in the new book by former DNC head Donna Brazile, who said that the DNC backed and supported Hillary during the primary, even though they were supposed to be neutral. When hearing this news, Bernie Sanders was like, hello? Who's on the phone? I can't hear. Hello? And Bernie supporters, they just changed the channel because this is a rerun. And the most obvious thing in political history, it's almost like nobody remembers just a year ago. Every Bernie voter knew it was rigged. I mean, that was Bernie's tagline. This is rigged. Right? Followed by, I'm not a Democrat. But of course, the president loves to look back in glory on his big victory, and he continues to point this out as if he's still running a campaign and secretly a Bernie guy and really into playing the djembe. You know, he gets that old orange mop top in the dreads. He just djembes all night long. He went to Twitter to taunt Hillary by quoting Senator Elizabeth Warren. He still calls Warren Pocahontas. Full stop. Can we stop? What? No. What? Politics aside, I never liked the guy who had a nickname for everyone, right? I mean, who does that? The guy who snaps towels at the freshmen in the locker room? I mean, did we elect Jason Narwicki president? Pocahontas. Ridiculous. Closer to home, the Cook County Democrats endorsed a candidate for attorney general, and it is, drumroll, State Senator Kwame Raoul. It's not that big of a surprise, but it is interesting after the news that former Governor Pat Quinn is interested in running. That did not change the outcome. When asked about why Quinn wants to be attorney general, he said, hey, there's just no more lawn to mow. You know, I got my hand mower out there just mowing my little lawn over and over and over since I've been governor. And there's just no more mow. Felt weird today not being able to read the DNA info, or Chicagoist. I found myself answering survey questions on the Sun-Times site all morning. Yes, I have used a microwave in the last 2 to 3 weeks. No, I don't have a Maytag. Although once I did get through, great piece on how Alderman Ed Burke represents Trump in trying to get property tax breaks here in Chicago. So far, Burke has secured Trump $11 million in tax breaks, and he's not done. Politics is fun, but money? More fun, right? A spokesperson for DNA Info said that the New York staff's vote to unionize played a role in abruptly shutting down the company yesterday. Owner Joe Ricketts has written publicly about his disdain for unions and how he doesn't want them at the businesses he runs. I mean, I guess I get that if you're a billionaire who loves money and doesn't really want his money to go to possible political causes that are against you, I guess that makes sense. But it's kind of the only way it makes sense. If the owner cared about local journalism as much as he said in that letter, then he really doesn't care about local journalists, does he? Seems to be a theme there. Business over people. The big government climate change report was released today by the Trump administration, and it concludes that humans are extremely likely to be the reason for climate change. Extremely likely? Not extremely extremely? Not indisputably likely? I don't know about you, but extremely likely is not just likely. So I think we need another study. A 2 or 3 year deal. In the meantime, pass me some diesel fuel, huh? Goop, 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 goop. Actually, that report was bad news, but scientists today said that the ozone hole, remember that? It's the smallest it's been since 1988, which was coincidentally the last time anyone said the phrase ozone hole. Works out. In weather, nice and brisk. Again, I'll take it, a little cold, but at least it wasn't raining. Tomorrow and Sunday, raining. It's going to maybe severe on Sunday, so watch out. In sports, now that that boring World Series is over, we can officially start looking to next year. Lots of question marks, surprisingly so, for the Cubbies. There's a chance come opening day that the roster could look quite different, but I'm just saying that for shock value. It'll probably all be the same. My move, I'd sign Jake Arrieta. I'd trade Hayward, Baez, and Happ for Mike Trout. Boom, done. Let's go get him. Go, Cubs, go. On the South Side, you wonder what the offseason will look like as the Sox are fully committed to a rebuild, which is just code for we're going to lose again. So the Sox will spend any money attracting free agents, or are they good with the old we're going to be good soon tagline? My move here, I'd dump James Shields. I'd trade Avi Garcia, Carlos Rodon, and Tim Anderson for Mike Trout. Boom, boom. Go Sox, go. The Bulls are in Orlando tonight. Remember that? Remember when that was a thing? Not so much of a thing anymore. Game started at 6 p.m., so right now the Bulls with a 9-point lead in the third quarter with 3 to go. Again, and can I ask a question as well? This is to everybody listening. Maybe I just missed that day in the news cycle, but why are the Bulls wearing white jerseys on the road? The other night against the Miami Heat, they wore white. The other night when they were at home, they wore red. Am I losing my Michael Jordan mind? We used to wear white at home, right? Red on the road. I can understand like one time through, but here they are playing Orlando tonight in white. It's ridiculous. Nothing is sacred anymore? I just saw the 76ers and Jahlil Okafor are unhappy, and the Sixers are willing to listen to trade offers, like second-round draft picks, which in the NBA is as close to being as free as you can get. Go get the kid that played at Whitney Young, and let's restart this Chicago pride thing, shall we? Get Jabari Parkey while you're at it, too. Trade Portis and Mirotic and Justin Holiday and get Mike Trout. Boom. Done. Go Bulls, go. Preseason rankings for college basketball are out. Northwestern Wildcats start the season as the 19th ranked school in the country. How about that? That starts in a week, by the way. That's amazing. The Illini start the season with a new coach. Brad Underwood comes from Oklahoma State. Here's a fun fact. One of the assistant coaches arrested in the FBI probe last month. Yep. An assistant under Underwood at Oklahoma State. So, good start. Haven't even played yet. Good start. College football this weekend. Northwestern up at Nebraska. Illinois at Purdue. And number 3-ranked Notre Dame hosts Wake Forest. And last night, NIU lost to Toledo. And finally, tonight, a new study looks at how our brain gets rid of unwanted thoughts. It turns out there's a chemical released in healthy brains that washes away all those nasty thoughts. When that chemical isn't available or deficient, it can lead to things like PTSD, hallucinations, and anxiety disorders. This is a huge deal because it gets to the root cause of why those thoughts that we can't get out of our heads lead to psychiatric issues like pizza. I mean, brain disorders like pizza. 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 Yeah. That's the pizza for November 3rd, 2017. Hey, we're looking forward to next week because we get a new shipment of ketchup packets. So for the weekend, we're rationing. For every order, we're just going to give you like 40 packets. Times are tough. All right, coming up, the Department of Cultural Pizza. Ah, did it again. DK's Commissioner Mark Kelly's going to join us. We'll talk about the year of public art, but also the public art plan and what 2018 is being designated, the year of creative youth. It's Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well. Did I hear you say you have 80 Quig coming in?
I do, yeah.
Nice.
Yep.
Yeah, follow her on Twitter. She's great.
She's coming in to reload the news coming
Super.
Up at 8 o'clock. So, yeah.
Nice.
Here you go. It's going to be a good one. I think it's going to be a good night. Already people are yelling at me.
About what?
This 331 says, your great savior, Barack. That's the only thing I pulled out of this. You and Obama are the dumbest people in the world.
Yeah.
So at least, hey, but you know what?
Yeah, let anybody into Harvard Law these days.
I just love that I've somehow become like me and Obama. That should be the name of my new film.
I didn't realize you were part of his administration.
Yeah, I'll tell you. All right, good. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's been a busy couple days for the mayor of Chicago when it comes to the arts. Just last week, the mayor announced the city's first ever public art plan, which laid out a strategy and some goals for the city to become a leader in displaying and developing public works of art. And then this week, he dubbed 2018 the Year of Creative Youth. He's investing big money into more artistic opportunity for Chicago's youth, culminating in a new fall festival at Millennium Park. And you add to the fact that the new budget proposal includes a plan to lower taxes for small to mid-sized entertainment venues, and the mayor is making a strong move to make Chicago known as the arts and culture city. In studio tonight, the commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, Mark Kelly. Mr. Kelly, good to see you.
Pleasure to be
always,
here,
Justin. Always good to have you here. This is something we've talked about on the show a couple times, about the public art plan and the year of public art, which was 2017. Talk about this plan. What does it do? What does it mean to have strategies and goals on paper?
Well, it's actually just bringing to life what's already taken place in the city. So we have unleashed some major forces in the city with the Year of Public Art. Everywhere you look, every neighborhood of the city, we have installations, sculptures, murals taking place. You know, we had Anish Kapoor back for his first selfie in front of the Bean, and Kerry James Marshall,
yeah,
and the list just goes
on.
I just went to a mural dedication in Lakeview this morning, and there's another one tomorrow. So public art has always been part of the history of the city. We have one of the greatest public art collections in the world. On the Year of Public Art, we've stretched that idea, the boundaries of what that means. And then the public art plan is this call to action to this entire city, that this city define itself with its public art, that every the streetscapes, the airports, the walls, the fences, the performances fill our squares, our halls, and it's all free, and it's all to bring delight to the city.
And how does that go about? Because these are suggestions and recommendations, and essentially it's the Department of Cultural Affairs and the mayor's office saying, yes, we are committed to this. But what has to happen when you talk about the city thinking about public art and streetscapes and fences and all the things that you just mentioned?
Well, first of all, it's the city itself and what we're going to do. So working with the park district and with aviation and with the library system and with CDOT and CTA, all these agencies, we're forming an interagency group all committed to public art. And then you start to see already examples like the new 95th L station by Theaster Gates. You see the public art showing up in more and more spaces within our park system. I have a commitment from our Commissioner of Aviation that our airports, which have public art in them, but do you think of them as spaces of public art? But why shouldn't you walk in the first connection to the city and you're inspired by the sense of a creative city, and it just is there for you, and it calls to you. So the city, we need to do more, we're going to do more. But then is the city, as in all the citizens, all of our cultural organizations, all of our SSAs, the local taxing bodies for business districts, the donors who donate to something that maybe in the past was going to be in an interior space and mm-hmm. there would be a cost factor? Hey, come on, donate to the next Picasso, the next Bean, the next series of performances. It's also stretching our boundaries of what we mean by performance.
I was going to ask about that. I saw that in the public art plan, the idea of changing the definition of public art.
Maybe it should be public arts because it's all forms of arts in the public realm. So summer dance is one of the greatest public art institutions we have, but we don't think of it as public art, but it is. And so let's circle around that. In fact, you should know we're going to be pushing summer dance. I want this to be this. It's the largest dance event of its type in the country, and we need to celebrate it more and push it out into every neighborhood. We dance. We come together. How do we come together? How do we build diversity? Well, we dance together. So it's night out in the parks.
Put that on the sign across the Skyway Bridge instead of the city of Chicago. We say, we dance.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I'm helping out here. I'm trying to help.
I like that. Yeah, we have to do something more with that Skyway Bridge mention it.
Well, yeah, you hang murals on the side of that. But I'm interested because this isn't to belittle or to think down on a plan like this because it's amazing and I support it wholeheartedly 100%. But as a city continues to look for places for revenue where we see more and more difficulty with our pension obligations and taxpayers are getting taxed more for property taxes, how do you envision the city moving forward to pay for this kind of stuff when you're asking private donations and organizations and other places to do it themselves? Isn't there a point where you almost have to just by faith hope that they do it?
Well, we inspire them, we push them, we cajole them, we show them the power of it, and we get people excited. And in fact, it's always been in our history. So it was the Art Institute through the Ferguson Fund who was the first institution, the Laredo Taft Fountain of Time in the Midway.
Yeah.
That was the Art Institute. So many of the great historic sculptures in the city came from them. And so I want them to go back at it.
Yeah, so
double down on what they've already done. The MCA, I think art has been redefined that artists want to be in the public realm. They don't want to be just in a frame. They don't want to just be on a stage. They want Kerry James Marshall, he jumped at that opportunity for that wall because he saw it as that challenge. Yeah. He saw it as sort of closing the circle. But Kerry James has there's a deep democratic impulse in his work. And so you don't want to just be in a museum. You don't want to be just in a collector's wall. So we need to, at the heart of this is big ideas. So I hope people, when this plan is an intellectual treatise, first of all, it's not just a to-do list. Because to-do lists sort of, your imagination isn't untethered by what it means. It's just sort of straightforward
check
language.
Check it off.
But
right.
we have the history of public art, because we have to understand what we've already done, what we've accomplished. And then Thomas Dijah, his essay, it's killer. It, like, wow, this is the spirit of Chicago at its best. We're also a meat and potatoes town, a town afraid of its own shadow. We have a deep conservative impulse, and we also have this enthralling wanting to sort of push beyond the boundaries and this great creative spirit. And I want to call on that second part of the city. And we have a mayor who's totally committed to this. We engaged the aldermen of Chicago in public artwork. And, you know, some people said to me as we were going to go forward with our neighborhood arts project, like, are you crazy? And they're not even going to be interested. And literally, almost everyone signed on. They've engaged in it. They've engaged their community in it. They've engaged their youth. You know, we had to have rules of road so that it was qualified artists and such. But great cities are filled with great art. Yeah. It's that simple. And we are a great city, and we need more of that great art, and it needs to be in the public realm.
Commissioner Mark Kelly of the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events in studio with me. Let's do this. We'll take a break, come back, and let's talk about the Year of Creative Youth 2018. Really, that plus the amusement tax lowering, the lowering of amusement tax for mid-sized, small entertainment venues kind of go hand in hand. But we'll talk about that. Commissioner Kelly in studio tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with me, the Commissioner of DCAS, Department of Cultural Affairs and special events. Mark Kelly, we're talking about the Year of Public Art, the Public Art Plan, which just came out. The mayor announced it last Friday. And also this week, the mayor dubbed 2018 the Year of Creative Youth. What does that mean?
Well, one of the greatest parts of Chicago is the myriad organizations that work with our youth and inspire them to take creative paths. It's not necessarily helping them become artists. That's an individual decision. But whether it's Sky Art or whether it's Marwin, After School Matters, U-Media, the list goes on and on. There's scores and scores of organizations, and they've never been celebrated. So the first part of the Year of Creative Youth is celebrate all the great work that's already going on. And then you see the fruit of that work, because around the country, there's sort of an understanding, wow, things are hot in Chicago. There is just a lot of talent coming out of Chicago. And you look at the biography of all these individuals, and they're coming out of After School Matters and U-Media and such.
It's amazing.
This is a fertile ground for them. And then we want to elevate all of this work. We want to encourage, inspire more youth to take the creative path. Our youth do not want to be edified. They don't want to be lectured to. They just want to make, create, design. They want to be on a stage. They want to compete. And we should encourage them. That is part of the public art, if you
will. Well, it's interesting, too, because in reading the press release, you know, it talks about the mayor's initiatives for a summer jobs program this summer. It talks about this initiative to be the Year of Creative Youth 2018. Is the Year of Creative Youth, is it effectively an anti-violence program?
Maybe that is an outcome, but that's not the intent. And our youth do not want to be joining anti-violence programs. They may be concerned like anyone about violence, but they want each of them wants a path forward for her or himself, and we have to offer that. But of course, when you engage people in creative work, they learn discipline. They learn how to work as a team. They become inspired.
Self-worth, confidence,
The development, whatever path they might take, is incredible. I don't know of a better way in our culture to develop our young people. They love the creative world. They want to be part of it. Let's offer it to them. We're not trying to put stars in their eyes. Actually, we're going to make them work their butts off, because that's what creative work is about, is working hard. So they're working on the murals, they're working on the fashion, they're working on their beats. And then we're going to have a giant creative youth festival in Millennium Park. If we value our creative youth, then we have to put them in our living room.
You know, any listener to this program knows how much I harp on. Every time we have a different artist in studio talking about, young kid from Chicago talking about their work, ultimately they bring up that they met and collaborated with other artists at Harold Washington Library, or maybe After School Matters downtown, or some city program. So it's, and I've always said this in the show, that, you know, I wish the city would recognize that. And to see that this is happening and there is a recognition of it, it elicits a little civic pride.
We're going to be offering grants to cultural organizations. They're going to go harder and deeper working with creative youth. We just announced the first six. We'll be offering some additional mini grants. Again, I'm going to be encouraging all of our foundations to get into this and help support all of these creative groups, help support us in this work. And just like public art, I hope this, it's not just to be a Year of Creative Youth and, oh, we're done with that, but it sort of sets a new bar, a new expectation, and the intersection of public art and creative youth is obvious.
Because I think about, you know, also with the amusement tax, about taking or lowering the tax on mid to small size entertainment venues, places, music venues like Metro or Empty Bottle in Chicago, or small theaters. It does make me think, because the national storylines and narratives of Chicago have turned negative in the last year. Political has a lot to do with that, just about the way the president speaks of town, and obviously violence. Is this idea to push back, to change a national narrative about Chicago, to say that this is an arts and culture town? You should know of all the great people that come out of here. You should know about all the great things. Hey, we're a creative town.
The intent is not to create a different narrative, but surely that narrative unfolds from this work. So the impulse on public art was sort of flows out of our history and what we've done, and the same with creative youth. But it does tell a richer, more complex narrative. You know, there is a lot of violence in the city. We are a segregated city, but we're a lot more than just that. And actually, the places where we most come together is in culture and the arts. So, you know, Millennium Park is a great public art park, and it's the most Democratic space in the city. Some feared, oh, this is going to be this elite space for the, you know, the fancy people.
For tourists and who come downtown,
Wow, you know, we go to Millennium Park on a Saturday, and it's just this wild scene, and the brides from every culture in the world. And
let me ask you,
there's
this.
A good story.
We only have a minute left here. How are you paying for this? How are we getting a tax cut at this point for mid to small sized entertainment venues? How are we funding into a year of creative youth? Where's the money coming from?
Well, so DK's, my budget is the same budget as last year, but that's a good thing in a city with a pretty tight budget. But we're rallying support. Actually, we have additional support for the Year of Creative Youth from the changes in the tax structure. So the big boys, Wrigley Field and United Center, are going to be paying more. They're going to be paying at 9% like their sporting events. But then the local, the smaller theaters, there will be no tax. And I want to emphasize that, no tax for nonprofits and for theaters below 1,500, encouraging the local scene. We become a better incubator. It sort of flows again right to the Year of Creative Youth, that our youth will have stages available to them that otherwise would be hard to get to because it's the economics are now more in their favor.
Exciting. Commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, Mark Kelly, in studio talking about the public art plan, the Year of Creative Youth 2018, and, of course, no tax for not-for-profits that are small to mid-sized entertainment venues. Commissioner Kelly, thanks for coming in, explaining some of this stuff to us, and good luck.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Coming up, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Craig Newman, 80 Quig in studio. It's the biggest story, winners, losers, overreported, underreported. Which story took you down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes from this week? Feels like so much happening. And we were just, as we get ready, Craig's here, we were talking about every time he's in here, it seems like the week in review becomes the day in review. Because there's so much that's happening, so we'll talk about that. Also coming up in the later in the show, in the 9 o'clock hour, David Kadesky's going to be here. Love David. Been a guest a couple times on the show, talking about his cabaret show at Davenport's, and then the band Partner will also be here, just named by Stereo Gum to be one of the bands to watch 2017. So we got a lot to do tonight, so we'll get to it. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. It's time to reload this week's news. Biggest stories, winners, losers, overreported, underreported. Which story took you down the rabbit hole, and which story will be remembered from this week, 5, 10, 15, 50,000 years from now? We're gonna attempt to answer that question along with your help, 312-981-7200. In studio tonight, 80 Quid. She's a reporter at The Daily Line. We love The Daily Line here. She also does a podcast, Aldercast, which you can hear at WGN Plus. AD, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And Craig Newman back. Of course, the former editor, managing editor over at Sun-Times. Did some Cranes, freelance editor now, and a regular here on The Download. I could say that now, right?
Three times as a regular.
Three, yes. All right. Craig, good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you.
All right. So let's get to it. I mean, I kind of mentioned at the top of the hour that it's kind of fun to have a reload segment when we really, there are a lot of big stories and not necessarily what's the biggest.
Right.
Like we've done some stuff. Craig, you've been on a couple of times where it's like it's a no-brainer what the big story is. This week, it's varied. But why don't we start with you, AD? What do you got for your biggest story of the week?
My biggest story is kind of an encompassment of all the other big stories going on. So it's Donald Trump's Twitter getting shut down for 11 whole minutes.
It's a good start.
Well, the best 11 minutes of our week.
Well, it was as all this other stuff was going on. So we had Bo Bergdahl. We had this huge climate report, Trump's visit to Asia, Obamacare open enrollment, tax reform. And we had no idea how long this account was going to be down. But it's his megaphone. And what does he do without his megaphone?
I have to say, did that happen on Halloween? Or when was that? That was like the day before?
Yesterday.
I got to say, it does. I mean, it really does. It's a problem with this week. But a story that happened, and I actually, it might be because I have taken a stronger stance that I'm not that in. I kind of go out of the way to avoid Trump Twitter. You know, the way that I know that he's how he's using it, and I'd rather get to the issues as opposed to that. And it wasn't until I started seeing Twitter actually respond and how they responded, saying it was an employee,
right,
that I realized what a big issue this was, because this has to do with
security.
I mean, we are so worried about hacking and security and what could happen if someone got their hands on such an influential Twitter account. It's a really big deal.
Absolutely. And, you know, the whole discussion, especially with the social media platforms being at before Congress this week, it plays into that. It plays into the fake news cycle. It plays into the what can you believe and what can you not believe. On the face of it, it seems ridiculous and or a blessing that we don't have Trump to tweet 11 minutes in our life. And, you know, I think I'm old enough as the rest of us to remember when there was a big discussion about whether Trump Twitter is even news because we hadn't decided that those were basically his press release platforms
right
at the time. But, yeah, you know, I wanted to laugh it off, but then you see a disgruntled employee is shutting down the president of the United States information dissemination platform, and it does become a concern.
Well, and he could have tweeted from the account, this person, and used Trump's words and said, let's go nuke North Korea.
Right.
Which would we notice the difference?
Right.
That's disturbing.
Yeah.
It's disturbing, and, you know, for whatever political reasons or disgruntled reasons that this Twitter employee did it, the idea that it reminds you that the president is using a public platform that we all use. He has a login and a password just like us, and people behind that platform have access to our, not just his, but our accounts if they want to get into them. It's kind of mind-boggling when the more you kind of unpeel or peel back, the more you realize what a big story this is.
Well, you know, back when I was still teaching, I used to tell my students, if you're using a free platform and you don't know what the product is, you're the product, right? And the president can't escape that either. So it's not your platform to own, and it's not really your content to own,
and it's not really secure,
and it's not secure, yeah. And he's using an insecure phone.
All right. Yeah.
That's a whole other discussion.
So, you know what? I saw that on the list because I had kind of had it in overreported because after that came out with Twitter, it was just retweeted to death. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it does rise to the level of biggest story of the week. All right, Craig, what do you got for biggest story of this week?
Well, I looked way, way back into Monday morning when we were all shaky and waiting for Robert Mueller to come out with his promised indictments. And, you know, here it is on Friday, and it seems like that story is almost semi-forgotten. You've got Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman, struggling to find bail or bond money. You've got his business partner who's been thrown in. You've got this mystery guy, Papadopoulos, who was I'm wearing a DePaul sweater, but he is a DePaul graduate from right here in Chicago. Yeah. You know, this is the drip, drip, drip of an investigation that lots of people had claimed is fake news or drumming up nonsense is starting to seem a little bit more real, or a lot more real.
Well, it's also added extra from the president Twitter as he has opened up the war once again with Democrats and Hillary Clinton to distract. I don't want to use that word necessarily, but just to point out that there are also inconsistencies with their stories in Russia. But it is interesting that, this is what some say may be the first shoe to drop. And others who say that this is just a witch hunt, and even conservatives in Congress today saying they put a non-binding resolution saying they wanted Mueller to resign.
Which is shocking because he was originally appointed under the Bush administration. He's a Republican, like a card-carrying Republican, a Vietnam War vet, a distinguished member of the law enforcement community, including running the FBI through a couple of presidential terms, including into the Obama administration.
Well, they said they wanted a conflict of interest because he was buddies with Comey.
Yeah, which is stunning. Yeah. I this seems like the most unimpeachable person you can find, not just in D.C., but probably in most corners of the country. And, to his credit, it doesn't seem like he cares. To his equal credit, there have been no leaks out of his investigation.
Right.
That seems to me to discredit the idea that there's some sort of witch hunt going on.
Well, I can't believe that he was able to keep this under wraps for a full month. I mean, Papadopoulos, pled guilty at the beginning of October, and it just came out this week, and none of us knew.
And was arrested in July,
right?
In a public airport.
Yeah,
it's pretty impressive to think about an investigation and a law enforcement endeavor of that scope that's just been silent. And the Papadopoulos thing, I think, is kind of a stunning development. I think there's going to be a lot more of these unheard of people that, that you know, float up from the
bottom. I read a great story today, and I can't remember who where it was because that's how Twitter works these days. But the idea that Trump just last week was talking about how he has the best memory in the world.
Or how do you say it? The best memory of all time, greatest memory.
And they asked him today about the meeting with Papadopoulos. He's like, I don't recall.
Like just, when you're like, I thought you had the best.
Oh, where everyone was sitting at the conference table.
Yeah,
he's right like, there.
It was unimportant. It doesn't matter. I couldn't tell you what was said in that meeting. I thought you had the best memory of all time. I just thought it's kind of a good point. Okay, the there's a couple other stories, and we'll get to all this stuff tonight. But the other stories that I had on the list, I mean, it's amazing to think about. DNA Info, we'll talk about that. Closing up shop abruptly, not only in New York, but here in Chicago as well as Chicagoists. The terrorist attack in New York City is another one that interesting once again about, I mean, I thought it was interesting. We can talk about the foreign policy approach for President Trump with the attacks today in Somalia and the airstrikes and what he said, which he's like, if you hit us, we'll hit you harder. I mean, he's really taking a stance, and it begs the question about whether or not, even though ISIS took responsibility for that, and we all know that there's no proof for them to do that, they just do that because they want to spread their message. You know, the question being that idea of if you strike, we strike harder, does that work? And then the other, I mean, the other that we haven't talked about, and we'll talk about tonight, is tax reform. A huge, the first time since what, the late 80s, mid to late 80s?
Reagan administration,
that we are seeing a change in the tax code, and we will talk about that tonight as well. Craig Newman, A.D. Quigg in studio. We will take a break, and we'll get started with our winners and losers coming up here. So we reload the news, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200, 630, talking about the Trump Twitter. How did that happen? So interesting. Did he lose his mind, the president, and tell someone to fix it? Did Twitter get a call from the White House? It's very interesting to see what would be a good quick documentary about a thriller, if you will, about the 11 minutes of the president.
Well, on the way here, I was listening to NPR, and they were talking about this was actually a contractor from halfway around the world.
Yeah.
And that there are a lot of contractors with authentication privileges that can take people on and off.
Oh, that's got to be such a pain in the butt for Twitter right now.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it took me 6 months to get an account unlocked because I forgot my password. So there are levels.
There are levels. 312-981-7200. We're about to transition to the winners and losers. Craig Newman, A.D. Quigg in studio tonight. All right, so let's get to winners and losers. I think it's interesting because the story continues to evolve. But why don't we start with the revelations that came out of Donna Brazile's upcoming book about politics and essentially calling out that Hillary Clinton and her camp had control of the DNC and essentially colluded, if you will, to keep Bernie Sanders out. I had in my winner category Bernie Sanders because, truthfully, you know, for a guy who lost a primary, you couldn't be a bigger winner right now in the way that someone took it from. This is exactly what Hillary Clinton wants from Donald Trump, this idea that it was stolen, this handed to. But, Craig, you say even the revelations today have changed. The story continues to change and develop.
Well, because nothing is cut and dried anymore, right? So, right. Yeah, I guess the reporting now is that Hillary's camp was given some sort of authority, or they had worked out a deal to have some sort of authority into the general election, not during the primary season. But, you know, there are a lot of questions to be answered about timing, when was what was discussed. You know, obviously there was the whole scandal about Donna Brazile giving maybe one question to the Hillary camp during one of the debates. You know, I think there's a lot of things that happen, especially in a major presidential campaign, with the political parties and the power structures they're in, probably on both sides. And, you know, did this exceed the usual hardball being played or not? I don't know that there's an answer to that yet.
You know, and I would say, Adit, what I find to be intriguing is that this is all history in the way that this candidate and this party lost an election. It's like if we were continuing
history,
to,
stop reliving.
We can't stop. And the idea that if it was the number one story in the media that Mitt Romney, and it kept going back to Mitt Romney after he lost to Barack Obama, but it just wasn't that way. What do you think it is? Is it pushback that people are pushing back at this movement that people think that the Trump presidency is illegitimate, and that this is kind of a way to push back at that?
I think part of it is Trump himself pushing this over and over and over again on Twitter, and he's got a horde of people who are pushing interested in that as well. Right. And people don't feel like it was resolved. I mean, people are still so torn about this presidency. No one has really been able to move on. So I think the fascination with what happened during the campaign continues. Yeah. As well as the Russia investigation.
And we are fundamentally now a squabbling nation, whether right. it's about this or race or what taxes or whatever, you know.
Guns, we're just
at each other about everything. And this is, and in part of it's the Clintons. You know, they cannot have a positive image in the media, and a large portion of that is on them. But they won't go away, so, you know, they get things lumped on.
I was thinking about this the other day that, I mean, even... And maybe it's revisionist history on my end, but I feel like even the Bush-Gore election of 2000, at a certain point, you got to 2001, and 9/11 had a lot to do with that, moving on. But even this just seems more. It seems like every day there's some sort of investigation or bombshell or developing story about an election that is a year old now.
There's at least two congressional investigations underway around the Clinton campaign, and that's the losing candidate. You know, it's not going to end because... No side will allow it to end. And I don't know if that's because the right needs an enemy or the left is fighting with itself over who the legitimate candidate is. But, you know, it just keeps sitting there spinning.
And Trump keeps calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, which just drives me crazy. It drives me crazy. It drives me crazy because I'm like,
unnecessary.
This, it's just decorum. Like, I don't know. Like, respect. This is a senator.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I don't understand how he has a little pet nickname.
Racist one.
It's
a vehemently racist one.
It took me a second. I was talking with Pete before. I'm like, what is the origin of that again? Like, and he reminded me that she claims that she has Native American ancestry, which I'm like, even worse. Like, now it's gross that he's like, he's making fun of what she claims her ancestry is. That's not acceptable in the United States.
It's just not needed. I think he can make points and you know, be tough about his questioning of various motives without, you know, stooping to third grade nonsense. Yeah. Or maybe he can't. I don't know.
You got on the winners. We talked about a little bit in the biggest story of the week, but you have your AD. You have Robert Mueller.
I picked Robert Mueller.
Who continues to be a winner. Even as people around, I mean, there's more and more stories that swirl around that will the president replace him? Is he compromised? A conflict of interest? But
right. But
he's doing his job.
What I said before was... It's incredible that he managed to keep this secret in, like, the age of leaks and Twitter and the FBI and CIA in the states that they are and low morale and all that stuff. But efforts to discredit him have fallen flat so far. So there's a Washington Post poll. 58% majority say they approve of Mueller's handling of the investigation. 28% say they disapprove. At the same time, 49% think it is likely Trump himself committed a crime in connection with possible Russian attempts to influence the election.
That's and I'm, you know, sitting in this chair, and I was just arguing with somebody on text about it. You know, the idea that Russia, and we've seen this with the social media platforms being at Congress but the idea that Russia would influence our election in some way or another, everyone should be appalled by that.
Yes.
Regardless of
should accept it.
Yeah, everyone should accept it. Right. There you go. Perfect way to say that. Accept it. Any political candidate that accepts that and says, you know what, this interference can help me, or let's work together because this can help me get elected, that's unacceptable.
Or doesn't understand that it's detrimental not just to both parties, but to our core strength as a nation, which is a free and flowing democracy.
Right. And I guess the question, I think, for Democrats and for people on the left is if your candidate was in the same position and the right was appointing special prosecution and they wanted to know, and all this, I think you would have to recognize at some point that regardless of party affiliation, there's American affiliation, and the idea of colluding with a foreign adversary to essentially win a power seat is unacceptable.
Well, and how it's fundamentally undermined our system. And that was their goal, to undermine our trust in news and the way that we receive information, and they succeeded.
Well, and I think you've seen the way they've used the platforms is to pit us against each other. And to a large extent, they've succeeded. You know, they've undermined our ways and means of living.
Right.
Excuse me.
Yeah. All right, Craig, let's go to yours, which I think is great, because I think it can fit in so many different categories. You have in the winner category, I would put it in the underreported category, but Chicago Violence, which shows up in the Reload every single week in some category or another, rarely does it show up in the winner category, but the numbers are trending in a positive direction.
Yeah, and you know, we were kind of chatting during the break. We don't quite know what the reasoning behind it is, but certainly, you know, just a couple of quick numbers that shot and killed is down about 7% year over year. Shot and wounded is down about almost 16% year over year. Total shot down about 14%, and total homicides is down about 11%, I want to say. So, you know, we still see too much violence. We still Absolutely, have almost 600 people killed in the city of Chicago this year. You know, is this a sign for hopefulness? I don't think we have enough data to really...
And it's also an anomaly, I mean, because you're playing off of 2016, which was supposed to be an anomaly year. And it was supposed to be. We remember that about this time last year, we're like, whoa, these numbers are way out of whack from where it was 2 years before that and 2 years before that. And then this year didn't correct itself for the first 6 to 8 months. To see correction now is good. It's always good to have less violence, but it might be that 2016 was just, in fact, an anomaly.
Or we could be in an anomaly month.
Right.
It could be short term, and we don't know what's driving it either. We don't know if it's sometimes it's weather, sometimes it's sporting events. We really don't know.
Yeah, the CPD is saying that they're having more success spotting essentially pre-crime. They're figuring out better how to look at where crimes are going to happen, look at who's committing these crimes, and being able to act before these events happen. You know, I think time's going to tell whether or not that's actually the case.
But. That's such a great point. Time will tell, because all of the practices for Chicago Police Department are in a position where it needs time, to where you can't judge month to month or day to day, especially. I mean, think of Superintendent Johnson. Was he in a year and a half maybe at this point? I mean, it's interesting to see that if there is a trend and the trend continues, then it could be from some of the practices that have been put into place by the police over the last 6 to 8 months.
Right.
It will be interesting to revisit his tenure, you know, a couple of years in, because he was basically a street cop. He's well respected by the rank and file. There's all the stories that were done when he came in that he wasn't a Jody Weiss. He wasn't an outsider. Right. Is that paying off? You know, what's the morale situation within the CPD?
Yeah.
There's all these questions about overtime and budgetary issues, I know. And of course you have the DOJ thing kind of sitting in the ether, but you know, it feels like maybe there's a little bit of movement that could just be,
yeah,
military.
And they continue making some really interesting investments in technology in a lot of high crime districts. So 7th District, 11th District, they're using a technology called ShotSpotter, which can locate gunshots so people can respond quicker. They have these strategic command centers, like you said. They've made big investments in technology to try to get ahead of stuff.
Well, I have to say it's a first. It's a first to have Chicago Violence in the winner category. I'll tell you that, Craig.
Yeah. Well, enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah, right. Craig Newman, 80 Quig, in studio tonight. We're reloading the news. 312-981-7200. We'll get to your text as well. Coming back, we'll do the losers. That's a popular category. Lots of people in the loser category this week, every week, here on The Download. So stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's see here. 224 says, consider that Russia's goal is to not meddle with our elections, but to make the United States go after each other and become divisive. Please discuss that versus the political issue discussed when it comes to divisiveness. That's something to be said, Craig, about the idea that maybe it's not as political left and right. Maybe it's just they know that that's the division in this country. And they know they're just going to mess with us.
I think that's the direction we've taken it in. But there's been plenty of reporting that does indicate that they didn't really care. That certainly Vladimir Putin does not like Hillary Clinton. And that's fairly widely known. But you look at how social media was used, and they were jumping in on both sides of a lot of different things. I think the push almost certainly seems to be to have us become a much more divided nation, because that strengthens Russia's place in the world.
Right.
Until we figure out, you know, where our collective head is at.
It's been a pretty divided country, though. I mean, I watching Ken Burns' documentary in Vietnam, I was like, oh, this.
We have memes now, though.
Yeah. Now we have
memes.
Yeah, we have memes now, right. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I think that, and I wonder as well, because someone just, 630 just said, you know what, today's the first time in history that someone in the Democratic Party turned on Hillary and told the truth, and your program is only talking Trump. And I guess the question is, and when you say about the
he
is the president, of course, and he's got his hands in a lot of other things besides a book tour that Hillary Clinton has her hands in. And what I think that people sometimes conflate is this idea that all Democrats love Hillary Clinton. And I'm not sure that the Democratic Party and the voters, I mean, we saw that with the Bernie Sanders stuff. I mean, there's a divided party as well, and that's why they're out of power. In the way that there is a left that Bernie Sanders really kind of activated. And then there's a standard Democrat, Barry, that didn't have enough power to beat Donald Trump. So there is something to be said about, yes, it is an interesting move that Donna Brazile turned on Hillary Clinton, but that doesn't surprise anybody who might be coming from the left that's happening.
Also, right. Also, Donna Brazile has a little bit of a public image problem. You know, then what do you do now? You write a book, you go out on a tour. I think there's some question, not necessarily about the veracity of what Donna Brazile wrote in her book. Is it Brazile or Brazil? I never really know. But there certainly has to be a lot of question about motivation, you know, that I don't think we've answered yet.
The other thing it revealed was the state of the DNC and how it has not been in good shape. It wasn't in good shape 8 years ago. It's not in any better shape now. And we're seeing state by state, a lot of state houses have turned from red to blue.
Yeah.
And their funds are extremely low. And it kind of showed how behind the scenes there hasn't been as much leadership as there could have been.
Yeah, and you know, I always remind people that in 2008, the Democratic, the DNC went for Hillary. They wanted Hillary Clinton to win that. It was hers to win, and Barack Obama came out of nowhere and maybe captured a little bit more of that Democrat, that left Democrat vote before Bernie Sanders did, meaning they had to, they almost, if you remember, right before the actual convention, Hillary Clinton was doing math problems.
Yeah.
She was trying to figure out how she was going to win, and even though all the votes were going Barack Obama's way, this is not new for Democrats. They've always been in a position where they're trying to mess with who's going to be the nominee and who's not.
Well, it's not new for the Clintons, who have been the power base for the party for a number of years, but it's been a tenuous hold on that power.
Right.
They're good at fundraising. They're good at controlling the machine structure of the party, but they're not necessarily good at measuring the zeitgeist of what the potential Democratic voter is. You know, I think what we saw with Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton rift is, first of all, you have a person come in who's not even a declared Democrat. He's grabbing a bunch of people who are dissatisfied with just the electoral process in general, and a lot of young people and people who really need some hope to look forward to growing out of their 20s and out of their 30s and finding a way economically in a country that's not really supporting them right now.
Yeah.
So he's got a natural constituency there. The idea that he can tear the party apart that easily is not so much about the weaknesses of Hillary Clinton. It's about the weaknesses of a party that doesn't really maybe have an identity like it thought it did.
Yeah, that's well said. I wonder, too, with the midterms that are coming up, and you hear from Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer who are saying, don't talk impeachment. They sent that message. I think I saw that this week, that they said to their party faithful and to the people in Congress, don't spread. That's not what we're talking about. We want to send the marketing of the Democratic Party as we are strong and we can lead. And, you know, I don't know if that resonates, you know, after watching what's happened, even as this infighting and the president himself able to stoke the flames because they're giving him the opportunity to do that with Donna Brazile and Hillary Clinton. But they're going to keep there is incentive for the president to keep that in the focus or in the focal point, because the truth is that's the dysfunction of the Democrats.
It shouldn't be forgotten, though, that the Republican Party is in no better shape. You know, they control all facets of the national governing structure and can't get things done. They're at war with each other about what they stand for. They're at war with each other about their faith in the president. You know, we have two parties that are weakened across the board. The news cycles tend to vacillate back and forth about which one's in worse shape. Today it's Hillary and Donna Brazile's book, and, you know, tomorrow it'll be back to Trump because he'll be tweeting in the morning.
Yeah.
I wonder if the DNC is going to do what the RNC did after Mitt Romney lost and put together a post-mortem and talk about...
And ignore it.
and promptly throw it in the trash. But if they will try to figure out what their message actually is besides we are strong and we can do this together.
Yeah, I mean, midterms 2018 right around the corner here, and then you start thinking about, and I hate to even say this, but you start thinking about 2020, and that's just the way it works
stop
now.
Right now. Now we're the loser.
No, losers, us. We're talking about it. 312-981-7200. All right, let's get to some of the other losers this week. Let's go down to Springfield, because this has been an issue when you talk about in the last couple weeks. We saw what they're calling the Weinstein effect and sexual harassment in Hollywood, in media, and now in state politics, not just state, national politics as well. But more people coming out and you know, for the first time, Senator Ira Silverstein from Rogers Park was docked his leadership. He didn't resign, but he just resigned a leadership post for allegations of harassment with a lobbyist. And what it really revealed, which is really the head scratcher, is there is no inspector general in Springfield. There is no HR department.
Yeah.
And there could be. They just haven't filled it.
Yeah. Our Springfield editor, Ray Hodge, broke that story that there has not been an executive at the IG's office since June of 2013. And
what?
So
what year is this?
We're in 2017.
That's been a little while.
So at least 27 people have made complaints, but the quote that she got, there have been no reports of ethics violations during that period of time, so it's not like there's something that hasn't been done.
How can you report something to nobody?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a semantics issue where they said, oh, well, there haven't been complaints, but it's just there hasn't been anyone to complain to.
It's startling too, because, and I feel like we're all kind of asleep at the wheel too, as reporters and journalists, in the way that Springfield, of all places, in the way that we have seen a budget showdown and everything about that's happened in the last 4 years, you would think that there was an inspector general making sure everyone was on the up and up, regardless of just harassment issues, which is really where this came up. But the idea that there isn't an executive in that office, and there hasn't been really in Rauner's term, it's incredible.
Ethics overall. I mean, we don't know what campaign finance. We don't know lobbying violations. There's just a lot of stuff that could have been happening but wasn't.
And the thing, again, Craig, and this is what drives me crazy, is the idea that the appointment is from the legislative leaders, meaning it's Mike Madigan and John Cullerton. They're in charge of making sure that office is staffed. We've seen this in Chicago. AD, you cover this. I mean, we've seen it over and over where the alderman will vote to say, we don't need an IG. We don't need an inspector. You know, they just get in the way. You know, and the idea that the actual legislative body is in charge of hiring their investigator is ludicrous. At the end of the day, it's like the one area of broken government where we're like, oh yeah, I guess Madigan's got I guess he's got a clean legislative agenda at his core.
We do have a pretty strong history of being of high ethical standard in the city of Chicago, yeah, and the state of Illinois.
Right.
So why worry about it?
I mean, but it comes to light, and because of it, it looks like this weekend they're talking about that they're going to find there's a watchdog that might be hired. I mean, obviously, getting back to the core reason where this came from, which was about harassment. It was about sexual harassment and run amok in Springfield from some of these stories. Do you feel like a watchdog and an HR department is the fix for this?
I don't know if we have already seen that the naming of names has been very limited. And I think it's because people are terrified about what will happen to their careers as a result, which is a cultural problem that will take a very long time to fix.
I mean, think about the stunning nature by which this came out.
Right.
You know, during testimony, essentially. And during the testimony, he was outed as a person who had potentially harassed somebody or acted inappropriately. No. Do I think an HR department or an IG will help in Springfield? I mean, we'd have to see how the office is going to be structured going forward, how it's going to be funded. You know, that's been a big problem here in the city. I don't know.
But if, you know, and this goes to just the idea that if this is now, this culture is at least, light is shown on it, and you get to a certain point where some people in power in Springfield recognize that behavior is going to get them in trouble, does that force the culture to change? Is that a win for the culture to say, you know, now maybe I'm not going to say that lewd thing that I used to say because, well, I guess it's wrong, like that kind of thing?
Time will tell. I am not optimistic.
Yeah.
I do. I have a limited sense of optimism around this, and we talked about this being on my winners list, that it's a conversation now, and it's a frank conversation. So there's a lot of ugliness about how people are treating not just women, but everybody in professional interaction.
Yeah, it's a power dynamics thing.
So, you know, the fact that this is a conversation and people are starting to feel empowered enough to be public about their concerns or their accusations, I think is encouraging. How we move forward is, you know, kind of a question mark.
Yeah.
But this is more than we've done, certainly, for some time.
312-981-7200. Let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll start the overreported, underreported. We're reloading this week's news with A.D. Quigg from the Daily Line and Craig Newman, a former editor, managing editor over at the Chicago Sun-Times and Cranes, freelancer now. 312-981-7200. We're reloading the news. Stay with us. It's Down Low here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, A.D. Quigg, and Craig Newman in studio. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We're still in the loser category. Coming up, overreported, underreported, which stories took us down the rabbit hole and which story is going to be remembered from this week, years to come. But let's stay in the losers category, of course, the Chicago News Consumer you've got, Craig, and this is our segment about DNA Info and Chicagoist. DNA Info, owned by billionaire Joe Ricketts, yesterday abruptly, shockingly, closes up shop. DNA Info, the site's gone, everything's gone. It also owns Gothamist, which owns Chicagoist here in town. 115-plus journalists out of work. Their severance package, of course. But the idea that this is a huge loss for neighborhood reporting and a site that was seemed to be gaining traction.
Yeah, it really was. I think the question since DNA launched, and maybe to a lesser extent Chicagoist, has always been how are they going to make money? And part of the problem we've seen is when you've got a billionaire backer or a news conglomerate of some sort, and granted that was a smaller one, that you've got that open-ended question at the end of the cycle. Are they going to continue to back it? You know, there's some question about whether or not he did this because of the unionization vote in the New York DNA office. Whether or not he has other motivations, it can't be because the money was hurting him. He barely noticed it. But at the end of the day, we end up with less journalism in the city, and we end up with a lot of talented journalists who are out of work. Seamus Toomey, the editor over there, I worked with at the Sun-Times, have the highest amount of respect for as a reporter and an editor. But we're going to get a lot of stories that aren't going to be told. With all due respect to the two newspapers in town and to the TV stations and WGN Radio, you know, DNA really dug deep. I live in the Ravenswood, Lincoln Square neighborhood area. I don't know who's going to cover that now. You know, there's just not a lot of local news that's going to happen at the very granular level for those of us who need it.
And it was helping us all pay attention to, and we keep, and I want to say that, you know, when you say neighborhood news or local news, you automatically think, oh, they're going to tell me who won the high school football game or things like that. But it was much more than that. I think in my neighborhood, the West Loop, there were some issues that were being covered from zoning, crime, other things that are relatable to everybody.
Yeah, I relied on DNA reporting every single day. So my job involves really granular city hall reporting. But if there was a zoning issue that came up, that means that it had already gone through this super extensive neighborhood process that some neighborhood reporter at DNA Info had been covering forever. So they had zoning plans. They had what the alderman thought about it. They had what the people thought about it. Like, I rely on DNA every day, and I'm kind of freaking out about the impact it will have on my reporting going forward because it gave me so much good background.
Well, DNA's gotten a lot of love, especially from you guys here, but I'm a big Chicagoist guy. I love that site. I've always loved it since 2004 when it started. I love the people that wrote. I love the voice. And I still found myself on a daily basis going there to see what they curated. But we talked about it last night at Scott Smith on, and we talked about what this means for Chicago, the news ecosystem. Is this an opportunity for people to come in and fill a void? Is it the end of an era, meaning that these kind of sites, the DNA Infos that are about ad revenue and the old way of making money, done?
Yeah, that's a great question because people just don't start media operations anymore. You know, there was a lot of kerfuffle around what's going to happen with the archive for DNA and the ISTs, the Chicagoist, DCist, New Yorkist, or Gothamist, I guess. You know, to come in and start fresh is a very daunting task, not just the money backing behind it, but you know, there's some talent around town for sure. We've got people that can write and report in this city. But being able to figure out a business model that thus far the industry hasn't been able to come up with, or to find a potential backer, Joe Ricketts style, who is going to put some money into your operation and hope that they don't get bored or angry with it at some point. You know, it's a tough solution to find, I think. You know, the first thing that jumped to my mind are two things last night were, is Chance the Rapper got a couple million extra dollars sitting around because he seems to be willing to jump into
poor
those
Chance.
Areas. It's like, or,
CPS.
You know,
any trouble in the city and they were like, where's Chance? He's Batman.
I think I have jokingly tweeted this at Edwin Eisendrath, the CEO over at the Sun-Times now, but it seems like a natural home. Some of that neighborhood, local level, local government reporting that they did at DNA, and to a lesser extent at Chicagoist, but that seems like something in their wheelhouse. You used to have the Chicago News Bureau that the Trib and the Sun-Times ran as a joint operation. It kind of filtered over the Sun-Times for a while. They've got their breaking news desk now, as does the Trib. But it seems like there's a fit there to be had.
Yeah.
But
well,
I don't know.
AD, I mean, the Daily Line's an interesting one. Your boss, Mike Fouché, wrote today about the idea that the service subscription model is the only way that's going to work, where people are going to have to pony up a monthly fee to be able to get the reporting they count on. And that's something that newspapers have tried. They tried paywalls and they've moved around, and it's getting more and more serious. I mean, you've seen that with the New York Times and Washington Post really kind of clamping down because they've kind of been porous and you can get around that stuff. But is that where I mean, is it time that we all have the frank conversation that you can't get news for free anymore?
I mean, I appreciate the job security of working somewhere where I know people are paying directly for the work that I produce and that they see value in it, and I am expected to produce value. I am hoping that everyone figures it out, basically. And I know not everyone can afford a subscription to us, but I think hopefully with some growth, maybe we can make it more affordable. Maybe we could do partnerships with publications like City Bureau, who has a membership model, or ProPublica, who has a foundation model. I think there will be an interesting mix, but I think a lot of the journalists that are leaving DNA are going to be hesitant to work at another billionaire-backed place.
I got to say, you know, I hearken back to a day when I was young and I would take 35 cents off the mantle and go, when I'd take the L, I'd pop it in the machine and I'd grab the Sun-Times, and maybe I'd get lucky that there was already one on the bus. But there was a time
yeah.
you paid. I mean, I paid 35 cents to have that paper and the news in my hand.
Yeah, you know, the whole information wants to be free on the internet model doesn't mean that you're getting something for nothing.
Right.
It means it's a free flow of information. You know, the idea that we can just get this like a soda or a cheeseburger and not have to pay for it is kind of stunningly short-sighted
weird.
A news consumer. And you know, you see people clamor when something like DNA dies or, you know, the Sun-Times is perpetually under the axe. But you know, people got to step up a little bit, you know, pay for news, pay for content. If you don't like what's being produced, make your voice heard. Put your dollar down and you know, jump into the game as an owner, essentially. But
there might be something in there as well to the key to unlocking the idea of what's news, what's fake news, what's free. You know, there's a lot in there that could change by just the way that we put a quarter or something
on
it.
It's hard to value something that has no value.
Yeah.
You know, I pay for the Washington Post. I pay for the Trib. I pay for the New York Times, and I appreciate that content. I treat it as something semi-precious because I'm paying for it.
Value in, value out.
I for one, am looking forward to a smart person coming in and thinking outside the box about this whole issue about how to fund the news. Because in the last 10, 15 years, we've had a lot of smart people come in and try to just make the model work. And it continued to get to this point where the model doesn't work.
It will be interesting to see what impact ProPublica has.
Yes.
Thus far, they have not done a bunch, and they're concentrating more on longer form things. Are they going to have a daily model of some sort, even if it's curated? You know, I don't know that we've seen that yet. But they certainly have a financial model that can bear some success.
Yeah, but I do worry that the billionaire model can be similar to the foundation model, where foundation might do the same thing Ricketts did and say, well, this doesn't really fit our portfolio anymore, so we're dumping
YouTube. I mean, the news co-op was the same concept. I mean, that's what I mean. It just feels like a lot of great, smart organizations and people, they come in and they say, I can make it work. and they all end up in the same place. So that's what we have to figure out.
I wonder, too, are we learning from those failures?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that that's necessarily the case.
Craig Newman, 80 Quig in studio tonight. We're reloading the news. We come back, we're going to get overreported, underreported. We're also going to look down the rabbit hole and find out what story is going to be remembered from this week. We will continue 312-981-7200. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Thanks, Rob. Download here, 720 WGN. Coming up at 9:30, David Kadesky, Naomi Ashley going to be here. Talk about their show, True Life Tales. Which is David's autobiographical story of growing up in Niagara Falls. And he does a story at Davenport's where he recounts the childhood memories. And some of those memories are true.
Which side of Niagara?
I don't know. We'll find out. Yeah. Yeah, I think the American side.
Right underneath the.
Yeah, right underneath it. He grew up in a barrel.
I was just going to say that.
Right. A.D. Quig and Craig Newman in studio tonight. We are reloading this week's news. We are to the point where we're overreported and underreported. Why don't we start with overreported? Can I start on overreported?
Sure.
iPhone X. I am so sick and tired of the same story every time this company decides to put a product out.
Is it as big a deal as it used to be?
It's probably not as big of a deal, but I saw on every single newscast, news play, I was on the front page of the Tribune, people wait in line for phone. I mean, it's just, all right, we get it every time. And this phone is not that different. I mean, it's $1,000, which is crazy, but I don't know. Like, I feel like we just, again, we don't learn from our reporting mistakes, and then we're like, big story, people wait in line.
No other product gets reported on like Apple products.
And it's not the greatest product. I don't understand. Like, I get the concept. I'm an Apple user. I love it. But, you know, there's a lot of other wonders and technology that are happening in the world right now. And you're right. For some reason, they have figured out, and I don't know what it is, their marketing plan, their relationships, the store right behind us. But people stand in line for
Which is very cool, by the way.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. There are trees indoors.
I guess so.
Yeah, you know,
I liked what was there before, the river.
Like, I get it when the first phone came out. And one of my editing gigs at the Sun-Times used to be with Andy Anacco, who covered technology and always had the first couple iterations. But now it's just an update.
Yeah.
And right. $1,000 one at that.
There's no more home button. That's a big deal.
You smash it against your face, right?
That's how
it
works.
All right, AD, what do you have for overreported?
Well, as a reporter, I don't really think there is such a thing. But every year, I get really annoyed during budget season when rodent abatement comes up.
Yeah. Classic. That's a great. That's the other one.
Yeah.
It's the other editor's iPhone and rats.
Yeah. Well, Chicago has, you know, our rat reputation. I think we're always in the top five in the world. But the mayor's office always rolls out all these different techniques to get rid of rats.
Right.
Dry ice, birth control.
Yeah.
Yeah, they make bait with rat birth control in it.
The behind my place, there's a courtyard, and what they like to do for there is they will have the fake plastic rock that fits into the, so it looks like it's just a rock. And
it's
the,
a hide a key for a rat.
Yeah, it's a hide a key for like rat poison.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this year, the mayor allocated an extra $500,000 to rodent abatement, and they have like a special SEAL team for rats. And they're replacing a lot of people's trash cans to make them super strong and rat-proof.
My favorite rat story is, I remember, I'll make it real quick, I was on Halsted and I went to Alinea, the greatest restaurant in the world, right? And this was the big thing where you just spend so much money and you're like, this is it, I'm never going to eat like this again. And when you're done, they bring the car around, you're like, they're ready to go. And my wife is getting in the car and I'm getting ready to get in the car as I'm holding the door. And I look over about two doors down. And there's a rat that just, I'm like, oh, right, it's still Chicago. Like, it's still, like, you're still in building to building to building. I mean, the environment didn't change. I was like, well, there you go.
Yeah.
And they're Chicago rats. They don't really run away. They just look
exactly.
Like, you got a problem?
Hey, man.
They're trying to do like, hey, are you taking any of that Alinea food home?
Yeah.
What's up? You want to just hand that over? Yeah, rat abatement makes the list every year.
Overreported.
Let's go to underreported. You have, I mean, I think we kind of touched on this already with the sexual harassment stuff when we saw it kind of playing out in Springfield. But you say the underreported thing is literally that everything is underreported.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think this probably could even go into our DNA info discussion that there just isn't enough journalism happening generally across the country and locally in Chicago. But, you know, Springfield's been an increasing decrease in coverage over the years. You know, we've got some really excellent reporters that work there. There's just not nearly enough of them. You know, a couple of years back, even, we'd have 3-4 dozen people that might be covering the State House from Springfield, and a couple of people up here covering the local government. And it's just been this increasing drip, 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 dribble away from news organizations finding it to be important enough to staff on a regular basis. And
is it because the line item is bigger? Because you got to do housing, you have to live down. I mean, is that?
It's not that expensive.
It is so cheap to live in Springfield.
So what is why? I mean, because I would think that you just saw with the budget crisis and everything that happened that people do have interest in what's happening.
They do, but you know, I don't think you see a steady inflow of clicks. It probably could map out to when you started to look at internet traffic and how things are important to people on a daily basis. Which is a good thing to keep an eye on as an editor, but also a bad thing to keep an eye on. You know, we talk about the need for an IG down there. You know, journalists are an IG. So from 2013 on, they haven't had an official one. But to your point earlier about can the legislature really appoint its own inspector? No. But that's why we have journalists. That's why we have reporters. That's why we have editors. But, you know, I think we start to see a lot more things slipping through the ethical gap and through the legal gap when you don't have a lot of watchdogs sitting there perched on the top of the State House.
Yeah, I think we could easily have 3 or 4 people down there for the Daily Line if we could afford to send that many people down there. I was down there a couple months ago for the big education reform vote, and they have like a guest desk there, and there was a box with a bunch of old pictures. And I pulled out a black and white picture from the 50s, and it was 45 people standing on the Capitol steps, and it was the press corps from the time. And now we're down to probably less than 10.
Handful, yeah.
Wow. So this reload segment just turned into the internet sucks.
And that's it.
I mean, the internet has ruined everything.
And it should even be pointed out where that handful of reporters is from. You have one from St. Louis. You've got a couple people from Springfield. You've got a couple people from Chicago. But, you know, I've heard that there's a lot of the rest of the state beyond Chicago. They're not really getting their concerns covered whatsoever, except on an ad hoc basis.
Right.
The AP does a nice job, but they're, you know.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think. I mean, the concept that we talk about, the overreported stories, whether it be rats or iPhones. And if you are a news organization and you've changed the way you look at your metrics, and your metrics is just about who clicks on what, maybe, you know, maybe there's something to be said that people click on iPhone stuff more than they click on state politics. And it's wrong. We're talking about it's wrong. But in the guise of what makes a business click and work.
I like, too, that we transitioned straight from rat abatement to covering politicians in Springfield. That was nicely done.
I've always wanted to do a rat tracker, right? You know how they did the celebrity tracker for Gawker? But we do rat tracker. Where'd you see where's the last rat you saw? I saw it heading west on Ashland.
Can we mount cameras on them while we're at it? Yeah.
Did you guys see the gif of Marianne Ahern noticing a rat off camera? She's
now we can start an argument about how gif is pronounced, but that's for another show.
But, you know, I love Marianne Ahern's response there, because that is Chicago's response. That's everybody who's like, right off the bat. Reloading the news. We'll come back. We will get the rabbit hole story and which story will be remembered from this week. A.D. Quigg, Craig Newman in studio. Stay with us. All right, wrapping up the reload. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. A.D. Quigg from the Daily Line, dailyline.net. Also her podcast, Aldercast, which you can find at WGN Plus. Also Craig Newman, former editors at both the Sun-Times and Cranes, and he is a freelance editor now, both reloading the news this week. 312-981-7200. All right, let's get to the rabbit hole story. AD, let's start with you. Your rabbit hole story is one that I think is all of our rabbit hole stories, which is sexual harassment.
Yeah, especially I think a lot of women are rethinking interactions they've had over the years. I have been in the rabbit hole since Bill Cosby stuff came out, and then R. Kelly, and then Weinstein, and then Silverstein, and I can't get out. I think about it all the time. It has made me rethink my interactions with almost everyone I deal with professionally and personally. I rabbit hole. I can't get out.
Yeah, I mean that's and you hear that a lot from women, you know, in any profession at this point, because you know they really pointed out that this is Hollywood, and they've talked about political as well, and they talked about media. But I think that's very short-sighted in the way that people, I mean, this sexual harassment was so pervasive in corporate culture. It has in
service culture.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that, I mean, like we said a little bit earlier in the segment, maybe because the light has been shown that possibly, you know, there this could be the beginning of some sort of culture change.
Yeah, I'm hoping more people speak out, more women figure out how to address it head on and stop it instead of kind of shaking it off or just getting out of the situation and calling it out directly. Kind of scare more people and really communicate directly that what you're doing is inappropriate and wrong, and I deserve the respect. You deserve to show me respect, and I still haven't figured out a way to shoot down people that say inappropriate things to me, which happens all the time at the city and county building.
And to that point, I really hope it causes men to ask themselves about their actions and their thought process and their mannerisms and everything else.
Well, media, especially when you talk about the county building, I mean, how many times have we heard over and over about the Boys Club? It's you know, that this idea that it was such a male-driven business in covering politics and covering Chicago. And yeah, I mean, I would assume that it's just not to take a phrase from the president, but locker room talk gone amok, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm encouraged to see, I look over in the press box when I'm at City Hall and it's mostly women. I mean, it was Heather Sharon and Lauren Chulgen, who's now at NHPR, but we have Becky Vivi at WBEZ and Claudia, my colleague at The Daily Line, and Marianne Ahern. But
don't forget Fran Spielman.
Don't forget Fran. Fran is a legend, and she writes 5 stories a day, and she's terrifying. But that does not stop elected officials and staffers from saying things about the way I dress or what lipstick I'm wearing or what my hair looks like. And yeah, it doesn't stop.
To this day.
To this day. Even though the press box is packed and there are a lot of women in power, it still hasn't stopped.
Craig, what do you got for rabbit hole story?
I'm going to keep up with the rat theme and talk about fake news a little bit, but I want to avoid the idea of what is and isn't fake news and focus more on those social media companies that were sitting before Congress this week. You had Google, you had Facebook, and you had Twitter. Not the heads of those companies, but their lawyers that they sent into the slaughterhouse, and they got hit pretty hard by the congressional panel asking them how this happens and what are they thinking. But what came out of it is that they took a lot of money from obviously foreign entities who obviously had some sort of an agenda going on, and didn't really ask too many questions about why or where it was going, even when they started to see the trends within their own platforms. These companies continue to be willing to take the business advantage of being a media company without taking the ownership of being a media company. They don't want to admit to being anything more than a technology platform, and until that gets fixed, there's not going to be a lot that's
such an interesting story because, yeah, they are the – and you hear it more and more, and you hear it from the Michael Farrows and the former Rapports people at the Sun-Times – you know, Sagan,
the technology company that does content.
Yeah, technology company. They talk about the idea that's the main competition for a newspaper is Facebook and Twitter. It's not another newspaper. That's sort of the bygone era. But this idea that Facebook is a threat to news organizations, content producers, it's real. And the hard part about it is such a big business that they can choose how they want to be seen. And in this case, they're a technology platform. In a different case, they're creating their own material. I mean, in another place, they're just an advertiser. You know, there's so many ways that they have really kind of cornered the market.
Yeah, but what was the number that came out this week? 129 million Americans were served up some sort of fake garbage news on Facebook alone during the election cycle last year, which is a mind-boggling statistic.
It is, and I feel like I was served up some of that stuff, and I knew it was fake. And I think that I, as much as I want them to be culpable for their material, there is something to be said about if you thought it was real, that just goes to media literacy to a certain point where you're like, yes, you're right. I mean, you want Facebook to clamp down on this stuff, but at the same time, where is the individual responsibility kind of come to play?
Well, I do my part by telling my mom that the thing she just shared on my wall is nonsense. But, you know, it is a broader outreach platform.
All right, my rabbit hole story is just about brainwaves. We can skip it. But it's a good study I didn't carry out today. It's really interesting about how there's a new study that's mapping the brain to understand that how does the brain get rid of unwanted thoughts. So if you're in a situation like, oh, I don't really want to think about that trauma or whatever it is, there's a chemical that we release that helps us change thoughts, you know, change your mind or to change it. And what they were looking at is people that do suffer from PTSD or do suffer from anxiety or psychological or psychiatric issues. That chemical is the focal point, meaning that it's not there for them, or it's not enough, or they're limited. And so I don't know why that is. That's what they haven't figured out, why that chemical. Is it genetic? Is it environmental? What it is? But it's really interesting that this is an actual physiological makeup and not something that's just mental. And when we use the word mental like that, there is something happening that is keeping us from getting rid of those thoughts in some case. I thought that was fascinating.
I agree.
Good. All right. Good.
All right.
I love it. Love it. All right. You guys ready? Which story is going to be remembered from this week? 5, 10, 15, 50, 500 years. They're going to look back at November 3rd and be like, that was the day. What do you guys think? What do you got for which story will be remembered? 80?
I have a few.
Oh.
The big old climate report that was released this week leaked a little bit early, and it right. is counter to most of the policies and prescriptions that the Trump administration has been talking about, but they did allow it to be released. It's same stuff we've been hearing yeah. for a very long time about the human impact on the climate.
Well, 80, extremely likely. that's the joke of that phrase. Yeah. It's extremely likely. Okay, is that more than what is that? What is extremely likely? That was my favorite phrase.
Super duper likely. Super is the next
super.
Time.
Once yeah. it gets to super duper likely, I'll listen. But yeah. extremely likely, I need more proof.
Yeah, 13 federal agencies. Humans are the dominant cause of global warming. We're in the hottest period in the history of civilization.
Yeah, that is a good one. We're going to remember that when we're all too hot.
Go home tonight and read The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert if you haven't already. Along those lines. Fantastic book.
What's it
Craig,
about?
What do you got?
All of us killing ourselves through global climate change.
Ugh.
We are the asteroid.
Whoa. Ooh, mind blown.
I have the disappearing data of our federal government. 538 this week reported that the FBI released its annual crime statistics, and there were giant holes. As much as 70% of the usual data available was missing. We're looking at a big question about the U.S. Census Bureau and whether or not it's about to lose its leader. If he hasn't left already, I'm not sure. But where that agency is going and how they're going to administer data, which is obviously highly important to how federal, state, and local governments get funding, make decisions about policy, et cetera. You look at what's going on at the EPA and how data is being used or suppressed there. There's a lot of numbers that flow out of the U.S. government that are crucial to how we make day-to-day decisions, especially from a budgetary standpoint, that we're just not getting or we're starting to see slow to a trickle. And I think that's going to be a giant concern in the next few years.
My story that will be remembered is the change of the tax code. I believe that what will happen is that in 500 years, we'll look back and be like, remember the week that we all just got so rich?
I do remember that week.
That's what I'm going to remember. They're going to be like, if we're going to revert back in our society to caves, the cave drawings will show that 500 years ago when we simplified the tax code and changed into tax cuts from corporations is when really took off.
It may be 5 years until we figure out what this tax law says.
Craig Newman, 80 Quig, it's a pleasure. It was great, you guys. Thanks for reloading this week's news here on 720 WGN.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, the Canadian duo Partner will be here. The two women who they're humorous songs, and they're indie rock, and they are treated as indie rock. So they're almost like in a fun way, they got kind of a Weird Al thing going on. But they are Stereo Gums has them as bands to watch in 2017. They're a really great infectious kind of pop punk almost indie rock stuff, and they're from Canada, so we'll talk with them about their music.
Country.
It is a big country. They are from Windsor by way of New Brunswick. Does that help you?
It does. I know. I know where both those places are.
There you go. They were called. I have it in the lead. They were called the best up and coming band out of the North Atlantic. I forgot. I gotta look it up. But it's like a very specific region of Canada that they were considered to be the up and coming band out of. So there you go.
What is that? The Maritimes? No.
Yeah, I'll find it in the break, and I'll pull that script up. And then we'll also talk NASA coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, my next guests are bringing back their popular blue-collar, gothic, spoken word folk opera to Chicago this month. True Life Tales from the Honeymoon Capital of the World, some of which are true, is returning to Davenport's Piano Bar and Cabaret starting this Sunday. The show features stories by David Kadesky and music by Naomi Ashley. The stories comprise of David's sentimental childhood memories of life in the shadows of Niagara Falls. And some of those stories may even be true. David and Naomi have performed this fun and somewhat embellished musical retrospective before to critical acclaim, and they both are in studio tonight. David Kadesky, Naomi Ashley, welcome to The Download.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having us.
Naomi, welcome. David, welcome back. David, you have had a career in Chicago of performing one-man shows. You've also been in the Neo-Futurists with Too Much Light. But, but talk about this show, where it comes from, because it has elements, of course, the music, that is something new for you.
Right, but the music, the stories came first. The stories came as a result of I was hosting a weekly performance series at Live Bait Theater many years ago, and I was challenging myself to write a brand new piece every week to sort of open the show, and it was just going to be a short little thing. Well, these stories about Niagara Falls, where I grew up, became the easiest thing to write for me, because, you know, I had these thoughts in my head and I could embellish them pretty easily. And then I shared those with Naomi, and we got to talking about, like, maybe I could sit in on a set with her band sometime.
Yeah. And then about 10 years later, we did that very thing.
it took a long time of us just sort of talking about it and trying to figure out.
Yeah, we started maybe like in 2007. I did a series of shows at Uncommon Ground, and that's when we really started collaborating on these pieces.
Yeah.
And then in 2015, we put it all together and made a show, and we got a 5-piece band to back us up. We did the real deal finally.
Yeah.
We were doing versions of it throughout the years.
Right. Like, I would do a piece, and then the band would actually entertain the audience, and then I would come and do a show another time, and I would do a piece, and then the band would actually entertain people. But, you know, over time we thought, oh, we want to have the story have an arc, and so, you know, I ended up writing new material, and Naomi wrote some really beautiful original songs for the piece. So it was a really great collaborative effort. I mean, even the makeup of the band became a collaboration.
It did. Yeah. We were going to use my original band, who play with a lot of people, but one of the members, Andon Davis, couldn't do the dates. So then a friend of David's from the Neo-Futurists, Heather Reardon, played accordion. And
absolutely,
we're like, let's put an accordion in there and see what happens.
It's always room for an accordion, right?
Right, exactly. Absolutely. And now I can't imagine the show without an accordion.
Yeah.
Or
and
any
first,
show without,
you know,
an accordion.
I have to admit, Naomi was a little resistant.
I was curious, because I'm used to just playing with the same people and musicians I know and I'm comfortable with, because I'm not a composer where I'm writing everything and in control. So you trust a lot of the musicians you're playing with.
Right.
And so I just didn't know her.
Right.
But now she was fantastic.
We're gonna
be adding a
Hammond B3 organ. Yeah. Bassoon section.
The great thing about this story, of course, is it's True Life Tales from the Honeymoon Capital of the World, some of which are true.
Yeah.
David, you grew up in Niagara Falls, which, you know, gets the reaction. You talk about this in, you know, in different pieces about people hear that and they're like, what?
People live there?
Talk about, I mean, is that where the impetus to tell the stories of your childhood and growing up there is because people just can't believe that someone's from there?
I mean, it was only after I moved to Chicago and I would say, well, yeah, I grew up in Niagara Falls, and the people go, what? Are you Canadian? First. And then I say, no, I'm not Canadian. And on the stateside, and they'd be like, people live there? I said, yeah, it's like it's an actual place. It's a city. It's, you visited maybe the falls, but yeah, people live there on a day to, and I, you know, was a tour guide there and all that.
Were you really?
Oh yeah.
See that
number,
I mean,
674.
Number 674.
Niagara Parks.
Well, I mean, that's the intriguing part too, because, you know, I mean, how growing up in the shadow of Niagara Falls, one of the biggest tourist destinations in not just America, but in Canada as well. I mean,
international. There are pictures of me. I always like to say there are pictures of me in photo albums in like India. Where it's like, oh yes, you know, we were there in Niagara Falls,
right.
And like, you know,
there's David.
It's like, there I am.
Yeah.
You know?
But, I mean, how important was the falls to your life? I mean, was it something that, obviously you were a tour guide at one point in your life, but as a kid, I mean, is it just sort of like, well, that's Navy Pier, that's over there?
Well, kind of, but at the same time, I kind of knew it was like a unique place, you know, that it was a, not necessarily that I knew it was a tourist place, but that I knew that there was something special about the area. But then as I grew older, I realized, well, it's also like a really economically depressed former, you know, industrial powerhouse and has fallen on hard times and, you know, Love Canal.
Right.
And, you know, it just really became like this sort of bleak wasteland.
Yeah, what a contrast.
So, yeah. Yeah.
David Kadesky and Naomi Ashley in studio. They are both performers and David's doing the stories. Naomi's doing the music for True Life Tales from the Honeymoon Capital of the World. Some of which are true, which is at Davenport's Piano Bar and Cabaret starting this Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Naomi, you brought your guitar.
Yes.
So we'll get a performance out of you guys, which I'm very excited about, here on The Download. So stay with us. This is Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, David Kadesky and Naomi Ashley. They are the talent behind the show True Life Tales from the Honeymoon Capital of the World, some of which are true, returning to Davenport's Piano Bar and Cabaret starting this Sunday. David and Naomi. David, a longtime storyteller and performer in Chicago, has done a lot of great one-man shows. Talked about live bait. We do a whole hour on just live bait and all the things that happened over the years there. Naomi has been a musician in town for up to 20 years now. All right, so they're going to perform a piece here from the show. What are we going to hear here, David?
This is a piece. This is a segment called The Barn Burned Down and the Horse Named Moose Ran Away. So this is just a little segment of that.
All right, take it away.
Linda was the first one to tell me that Patty Gilliam was dead and that she'd been killed by the horse named Moose. The Gilliams lived on a small farm at the end of our street. They had a barn with several horses, two or three cows, some chickens, and a goat. I hated that goat. It had those yellow eyes. The Gilliams would often ride their horses down our street from their farm to the open fields just beyond the railroad tracks to graze beneath the humming electrical pylons that delivered electricity generated at Niagara Falls to New York City. Mr. Gilliam always rode Moose, an aptly named, massively tall and broad-backed chestnut. Patty rode a little spotted gray mare named Mandy. The Gilliam farm was across the street from my school, and on my walks home, I would often stop to feed Moose and Mandy and Mrs. Gilliam's horse, who in my universe was a horse with no name. When Moose lumbered up to the fence, my heart would race. The other horses would shy away as Moose wagged his huge head and stomped his enormous hooves. He would feed greedily from my hand, his great white teeth rumbling in his head as he chewed. I loved to look into his deep brown eyes. There is something so weirdly thrilling about a horse's eyes. So much is reflected back, it's like falling into a hole. Linda said the night that Patty was killed, she had a terrible fight with her mother. She stormed out of the kitchen and ran to the barn and saddled up Moose, something she was forbidden to do. Being the wild girl of the neighborhood, Linda knew a great deal about mother-daughter animosity. Threats, demands, and accusations would fly between Linda and her mother as Mrs. Cinchetti slaved over boiling pots of spaghetti sauce, or Linda ran down the bubbling hot tar driveway. Linda said that Mrs. Gilliam was too late to stop Patty and only could watch helplessly as Patty rode around and around and around the pasture at full gallop and could do nothing but scream when Moose stepped into a rat hole and slipped and fell and Patty went down with him and she did not know how to roll away fast enough and Moose rolled on top of her and crushed her dead. Flat as a pancake.
A morbid story there. Love
that's,
it.
That's one of the more uplifting ones.
That's growing up in Niagara Falls. Yeah. That's it, right?
Yeah. It was that, you know, I grew up on the outskirts of the town, and like it was farm country, and it was like old fashioned, like, yeah, because basically I'm a child of, and I remember the end of the 1950s basically.
Wow.
Because, you know, things move slowly there.
Well, the show is called True Life Tales from the Honeymoon Capital of the World, some of which are true. It's at Davenport's Piano Bar and Cabaret in Wicker Park, right there in Milwaukee. 1833 Milwaukee, I think it is.
I think that's the correct
address. That's close. Close enough. You can
find it. You'll get it.
It's next door to some ramen place. There'll be some guy with like a, you know,
I get you in the vicinity.
Mustache wax and stuff.
David Kodesty and Naomi Ashley in studio. This is a remount. You guys did this a couple years ago, and you've had success with the show.
Mm-hmm.
What? Talk about that. Talk about the formula and the emotion that goes into to putting a show up, a show you've done before.
It's a let's get the band back together
yeah, it totally
kind of
is.
Feeling. It's we had a run in 2015 and it didn't seem like it was enough. We did a one night only performance about a year ago.
Yeah.
Or 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And that wasn't enough. And
it
so
definitely was not enough. Especially in that room. It's a really great room.
It's great. Yeah.
The show really fits in there beautifully. And you know, Naomi's been away. She's been on the other side of the planet for a while. And
literally,
we had rehearsal just the other night and it was so great to just be like back in the room again. Yeah. And it was, you know, I mean, now I know how like Peter, Paul and Mary felt.
Well, and
every day, every year, you know, they get for that reunion.
Right.
And then, you know,
now you know.
So
right.
Good. All,
yeah.
And we have a 5-piece band. So it's me on guitar and I do vocals, but we also have a violin player, accordion player, bass and drums. And so it's really full. And each band member has a role to play in the show too. As far as their instrument represents different points of the story.
Well, David, so. I've seen you, and like I said, Live Bait and other theaters where I've seen you as a one-man show in the more traditional setting. Davenport's is more of a cabaret, as a classic cabaret lounge.
Yeah.
You know, just more of the tabletops. Is it different for you to be in a space like this?
No, this is a dream come true.
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
All the other stuff is leading up
to
this.
I never really realized that I wanted to be like in a band, but we started working together and all of a sudden I was like, band. You know, it's very exciting actually. Yeah. You know, and
the cabaret space works really, really well.
Yeah.
It's still intimate,
and people expect the music, right?
And people expect the music, but they're also, it's a listening crowd, and
because I think, you know, both with, and you know, Naomi's songs that she, you know, she listened to my writing and then she went away and wrote responses to what I had written, and to hear that different voice as a writer, it's thrilling to have somebody respond to your own work in that way. It's really exciting.
You know, even in listening to the piece that you just did about the goat or the because it's fun. The idea some of these stories are true or embellished,
right?
You know. Mm-hmm. At what point do you actually, you know, expect the audience to, do you expect the audience to pick up on the stuff that's embellished? Do you expect the audience to, because I was, you know, listening to it, I was like, what's the, you know, like,
I suppose that people will wonder that, but when I'm saying that some of them might be true, I'm talking more about the idea that, you know, memory is fallible, you know. And then
I may, like, I may not remember this. Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
misremembering,
so, right?
But I got to do a show, so I better, you better come up with something. But you know, whenever someone is telling a story, people can tell a story in different ways. You know, different people from different points of view or different abilities of memory. So, and I've always been interested in that and how things are remembered. So. This is just a natural extension.
Well, a true Chicago, I mean, really, a true Chicago artist, David Kadesky, been performing for so long, to now be on with a band. I mean, that's amazing. Naomi Ashley as well. The show is called True Life Tales from the Honeymoon Capital of the World, some of which are true, returning to Davenport's Piano and Cabaret this Sunday. And it's running through...
We're this Sunday and Monday, and then the following
Sunday.
There you
go. So 2 weeks to catch them at Davenport's. David Kadesky, Naomi Ashley, the show True Life Tales from the Honeymoon Capital of the World, some of which are true. Great to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My next guest, we're just in town playing at Dirty Nelly's in Palatine. Chicago, put your hands together for the Canadian rock duo, Partner.
When I was a kid, I used to fix it. Luckily, my mom and dad were pretty easy to trick.
Partner hails from Windsor, Ontario, by way of New Brunswick. The duo, Jose Caron and Lucy Niles, are a great combination of 90s straight-ahead rock guitar sounds and creative, energetic songwriting. Their sound is similar to bands like Weezer or, closer to home, Veruca Salt. They describe themselves as part musical act, part teenage diary, and 100% queer. Exclaim magazine called them Atlantic Canada's best lesbian garage band. And they just made Stereo Gum's list of bands to watch for 2017. They got a new album out called In Search of Lost Time, and they are in studio tonight. Jose, Lucy, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
First of all, how often do you guys get to Chicago?
This is our second time here, so we get here twice, I guess.
Yeah.
What do you know about Chicago? What about the Chicago audiences, things of that nature?
Well, last time we played here, we had a great turnout, so that was a lot of fun.
It's a legendary music city.
Really wanting to try some of that pizza. Maybe we should try some later.
There you go. I mentioned the music. You know, let's first talk about your sound. When you listen to In Search of Lost Time, it really does remind me of, and I mentioned bands like Weezer, but closer to home, Veruca Salt. Do those bands mean anything to you? When I talk about 90s rock bands like that, are those bands that you've studied and you are inspired by, or are they just coincidental descriptions?
We mostly heard of Veruca Salt from people saying that we sound like them.
But I know their one song, their smash hit.
I know that song, too.
Right. That's a sick song. I think it's the harmonies, honestly. It's the, like, we sing often in, like, I don't know if it's a third or, like, like that one.
Yeah.
And I also, it really does take me back as someone who liked Veruca Salt at the time and was going to shows like that. That hard-driving guitar that you guys both put on in the music that you've done for a long time, but also on this record, it is very reminiscent of a certain time and period. Are you fans of that time and period beyond Veruca Salt, but just those kind of bands?
Oh, yeah. We love 90s rock, for sure.
Yeah. We were in the car yesterday. We were listening to Weird Al, and it was the first time that I really listened to Weird Al, and then we realized that I've heard Weird Al before, but, like, the drummer who was driving insisted playing the whole album through. So the first, like, front to back Weird Al album, I was like, well, actually, we're more like Weird Al than anything.
Yeah.
There's something to be said about that in the way that, and I had a whole line of questioning about, your songwriting. There's a lot of humor in this, and there's a lot of clever and creative lyrics and really talking about your own experiences, but also, you know, just being funny. And where's that come from? Is that the intention with Partner more than being a hard-driving garage band?
Yeah, we thought the idea was funny, and then the sound came naturally because that's what we listen to anyway, but the concept definitely came first, I would say.
The sound was carved out of, like, just, like, as the songs were getting written, like, not with an intent to, like, make a guitar album, but it just, like, came out that way because mm-hmm. my dad was always telling me guitar stuff, that guitar was the coolest thing that you could ever do.
I mean, you mentioned Weird Al, but I think Flight of the Conchords and yeah. other groups like that. You really do, because when you look at some of the videos, you guys are hilarious in the videos, and new videos that are out, too. It makes you wonder, because the music, usually when you have those kind of a band like Flight of the Conchords, the music is definitely second to what they're singing about or who they are. With you guys, the guitar work is so intense. It really is an indie rock band. Is that by design to marry those two? Or, is, like you just said, is it just coincidental and you guys are Canada's favorite rock joke band?
I'd say on purpose.
I
think it makes the better it sounds, the funnier it is.
Yeah, we just love rock and we love laughing. So I think we just seem natural to mix them together.
And, like, rock is inherently pretty funny.
Right. Yeah. Even when it's not trying to be.
Yeah. Led Zeppelin, like, singing about Mordor and...
Right.
Mortar.
That's how serious rock is to people. They will take anything that has a hard guitar behind it and say, that's gospel. I have to follow that. And I think that's why, in your case, it takes a little bit, listening to it a couple times through, as you start to recognize that these lyrics could be songs in Saturday Night Live and things of that nature.
Thank you, Saturday Night Live. That's a big compliment.
I love the, obviously, the 90s sound. We kind of talked about it. But I also love that on this album, you take us back to skits. In between interstitials, I felt like I was listening to the Outkast record, but talk about that, the idea of putting different sounds and sketches and skits inside the tracks that are on the new record In Search of Lost Time. That's a lost art.
Yeah, thanks. I think we just really enjoy the experience of listening to an album that has skits on it. It adds a lot to the experience.
Well, we wanted to make it like its own universe or whatever, so like you put it on and then you're in our world for a moment. Like, we wanted to give people, like, as like best we could, a glimpse into like our world. So we've got like our label, our photographer, and my dad.
Yeah, your dad. Right?
Yeah.
So, and us as well, just like some more candid moments. Yeah, so it's just like, welcome to our world. Like, hope you like it here, you know.
Is the primary, and when you're doing skit and you're able to present comedy in different ways, and you guys are a music act, obviously the primary focus is on songwriting. Mm-hmm. But when you're coming up with an idea, are you able to say, okay, how are we going to treat this? Is it a skit? Is it a song? Is it a YouTube video? Like, how do you do that to decide what is ultimately going to be a song?
Usually we know as soon as we think of a song idea, it sets off like ding, ding, ding. And then there'll be like a natural melody that we'll sort of just like come up with by singing it out. And then as for the skits, we had the idea of pranks. And then some of the other like chatting stuff just happened while we had the microphone on. Like, we were trying to do something else, but then Jose started laughing, so it turned into that.
But that's a really good question.
Yeah.
Because like, thanks. We are getting into like more like mixed media and stuff. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So usually with songs, it's like, it's just like, you just know.
You know, as you guys have moved along in your career to In Search of Lost Time, you have evolved. The music is and the production has gotten much more advanced. The sound on this is a much lusher sound when you talk about the guitars and everything in there. When you talk about your songwriting and when you are humorous when writing songs, how does that evolve? Do you become better observers? Do you write better songs, write better comedy? How has your songwriting evolved as a duo from the earlier stuff to now?
Most of our stuff on our album and our, like, earlier stuff were actually written pretty concurrently. We just recorded the album later. But we're working on new stuff now, and we've kind of started getting into the idea of writing in different voices.
Mm-hmm. That's what we're experimenting
with. Yeah, we've been because obviously most of our songs right now are about our own selves, but we've been getting into, writing.
Like writing for characters?
Yeah, writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's characters, so that's going to be one thing. Gotten into the idea of writing jingles, holiday songs. We've just been really going pretty all out with the ideas in the last few weeks.
Because, you just have to, keep tearing down your limits as you go. I'd say that's the key to evolving. And so right now we're in a process of just, taking in everything and, not saying no, not pursuing anything. So jingles, Christmas songs, all of that. What we want to say is gonna come out. And
is it hard for you? Because what I know of your music, you guys are pretty not confessional, but you're revelatory. You put your who you are on your sleeve, and you write about yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you start to make that transition to writing for other people or as characters, is it difficult for you? Because you've really made your name on This Is Us. We're singing about this truth. It could be funny, but it's really comedy is about truth.
Yes.
Is it difficult for you to make that transition as songwriters to not write about yourself and write about somebody else?
It's tricky. We've only done it this, we're working on this one song, and this is our first time trying it. But, once you get in, you figure out, it's kind of do you know the, duck rabbit, metaphor? Where there's it's a philosophy.
One looks like duck and rabbits look the same if you change.
So it's kind of like that feeling. It's just oh, yeah, this has been there all along.
Yeah.
And you're just
you have to change your perception. Right?
Yeah.
Right,
and then, right. And then it's fine. So, we decided to, we wanted to write, a cowboy.
Yeah. I was trying to think, actually, which song you were talking about, because we wrote one song from the point of view of a goth, and then we're working on one from the point of view of a cowboy. And then another sort of fantastical holiday theme song. But, yeah, so far it's been pretty easy, I guess.
Once you decide, cowboy, what would a cowboy say?
Every song is still going to end up being, it's going to be these lesbians' idea of what it's like to be a cowboy. We're never going to stop being ourselves.
Yeah, so.
One thing about it is just about identity. It plays out in your music, of course, being 100% queer. But it is interesting because that plus the indie rock and the audience expects you to be funny at this point, the people who followed you, there's a lot of expectation from different audiences that are going to say, oh, this is what I like Partner for. Oh, I like because of music. Oh, I like because they're gay. I like them because they're hard driving guitar. There's a lot of different audiences that play. Totally. Is there one audience that you would rather perform to, or are you okay with the amalgamation of all of them kind of coming together?
Oh, it's great when they all come together.
Love it. Yeah.
That's kind of the beautiful thing. We'll get old dads and young drama kids and everyone in between. They usually all seem to be having a good time. But yeah, I do have a soft spot for the young teens and young queer kids and stuff for sure. But love all the fans.
And it's always really funny, people's reasons for liking us. It's just whatever reason they pick is just inherently funny.
Yeah, exactly.
My last question just is about you being a Canadian rock duo, coming to the States and touring the States. Are there different, and you've been to Chicago before and the shows are packed. Does the audience in the States act differently than the audiences in Canada? I have some friends who are comedy writers in Toronto, mm-hmm. other places, and I'm always perplexed at how close our countries are, yet the apparatuses of entertainment and industry are entirely different, whether mm-hmm. it be the CBC or the idea that you can be famous, rich and famous in Canada and not ever be heard of in Chicago and vice versa, I'm sure. But as you guys have really been a group that has had such success in Canada, when you make that crossover to the States and you do have people who are following you, is it an easy thing?
I would say we have been welcomed very warmly everywhere we go, and people, because of that our music is it's funny and it's at shows, if people like it, then they're in for the long haul. And
generally I feel the appreciation's coming from the same place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because rock is it's up there in the sky.
Rock is
the
rock, right?
Universal language.
Yeah, really the universal language.
You've got so many universal languages going. You've got rock, you've got comedy. I mean, you've got a lot going on there. The duo Partner in studio tonight, Jose Caron and Lucy Niles. You can find their record, In Search of Lost Time, which is out now on all the streaming sites. You guys, a pleasure to meet you. I love the music. Thanks so much for coming to be my guest on The Download.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hockey, soccer, basketball, girl, I heard you play them all. Well, me, I always drop the ball. Never stood a chance at all. But you, you're a superstar. I'm out of bounds. I've gone too far. Look across my heart and up to die. Can't believe I'm at triumph. Girl, you make me want to play that feeling. Can't explain the love I
All right, coming up, Sandy Marshall's going to join us from the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center just outside of Washington, D.C. He's there for a NASA social media event. Yeah, Sandy's always in, you know, Sandy's in a lot of stuff with the show. He comes in the studio, but he also has done different characters and fun. We've done a lot of comedy together. Member Schadenfreude with me, but he is out with a bunch of space enthusiasts. Because that's his thing. He likes space.
Yeah, I love Sandy. He's hilarious. Yeah, like you said, he contributes so much to the show. But knowing Sandy, and I've just met him through you. He always seemed like a guy that he went to space camp as a kid.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, nailed it.
Yeah,
yeah. He's the kind of guy that wants to go to space camp as an adult and continue to go to space camp over and over and over. I mean, he sent me an email saying, "You're not gonna believe this, man. I'm going to the space center. It's going to be satellites and lasers, man. Satellites and lasers." And all day he's got different pictures up of satellites and lasers. It's classic Sandy. So we'll talk to him about that experience coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. It is The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. She'll take over. 312-981-7200. We'll be back. We're putting a string together here, Pete. We're putting a string together. You know, I believe the beginning of next week, I'm opening up the show schedule right now. Yeah. Next week, we've got, listen to this, on the 6th, November 6th, it's Monday, Gail Simmons from Top Chef, the judge from Top Chef, from the original. Then also, I mean, next week is the beginning of college basketball. Who would you say, Pete Zimmerman, is the most famous college basketball?
Dave Corzine.
Okay. Who, I would say... Dallas Comegys, right? Some may say D. Brown. D. Brown, of course, the Illini fame, had the awesome haircut. That team that went to the 2005 National Championship game, lost that game. No one remembers that. Just remember that team's unbelievable, miraculous move. D. Brown.
Yeah.
My guest at the big table.
Played, I want to say he played at one of the Provisos, one of the juggernauts here in the western suburbs.
Well, he's over at UIC now. He's a coach, and we'll have him on the show.
Yeah.
There you go. D. Brown. And then we're on as well on Tuesday night. Producer John Davies will be with us, which is awesome. He's got a new documentary coming out on PBS about Chicago at war, World War II, what was happening here in town during World War II. And also coming up next week, we are going to talk with a Holocaust survivor. I'm very excited about this. The Illinois Holocaust Museum just opened a new center that gives visitors the opportunity to interact with Holocaust survivors through hologram.
Yeah.
And so they sent Holocaust survivors to Los Angeles and asked them thousands of questions. So that you can go into the room in Chicago and Skokie and be like, "Hey, what was it like?" And they can answer you. The hologram can.
That's amazing.
So we'll talk with one of the survivors who was interviewed. We'll tell his story on the show next week.
That's great.
Yep. So that's all coming up next week on the Download. So I'm excited. Looking at the thing, it's kind of hard to believe, but
I think we're here every day next week.
Wow. Yeah. Love it. All right. That's good to know. All right, so we've been teasing this out that Sandy Marshall, our good buddy from here at the show, is actually at the Goddard Space Flight Center just outside of Washington, D.C. It's part of NASA's social media event. A small group of space enthusiasts from around the world gather to talk with scientists and engineers and administrators to learn about NASA's efforts, about one satellite in particular, ICESat-2. It's going to launch in 2018. Sandy Marshall on the line from... right outside of Washington, D.C. Sandy?
Hi, Justin. How are you tonight? Hi, Pete.
Are you in zero gravity right now?
I am in space. I know you teased it out to just outside of Washington. I'm about 300 kilometers in a low Earth orbit, going at about 17,500 miles an hour. Great signal, though.
I was going to say, you'd be the guy who would be able to charm your way into an actual space flight from a social media gig.
That's it. I'd be like, guys, I'm going to tweet it out to 1,400 people, you know, 30% of which are robots. How can this not be enticing to NASA?
Russian robots, right. All right.
Huge audience.
So what are you doing there? Well, tell me about this, because you'd started to explain it to me at one point, and I glossed over. But explain to me what you're doing out at the Goddard Space Flight Center.
Outside of our comedy life together, I've been a lifelong fan of the space program and NASA. And so a few years ago, they started these events called NASA Tweet-Ups, where social media enthusiasts and space enthusiasts would come to NASA events and basically just cover it for their social media following. These things have since become a thing, and they're sort of these like close-knit events that kind of anybody can apply to, and as long as you kind of get yourself down to the event and you go through like this application process, you can hang out at a specific NASA location, sometimes even a launch, for a full day. You get the full like inside media tour. You get to talk to the, you know, astronauts and scientists and engineers who are putting this stuff together. And then you go home with a pretty cool swag bag. It's an incredible experience. And so today we were at Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. So you were correct in the teeth. It is right outside of D.C.
All right. So what are they doing today? Talk about your day. I mean, if you get a full day there, and if you follow Sandy at Marshall Sandy on Twitter or Instagram, you can see all the pictures. But take us through the day out at Goddard.
Sure. Well, this day was focusing on a specific satellite that's going to be launched in 2018. It's called ICESat-2, and that stands for the Ice Cloud and Land Elevation Satellite. It's been being built at Goddard since 2007, and Goddard Space Flight Center is actually the oldest space center of NASA. It's named after Robert Goddard, the guy who created the world's first liquid-fueled rocket, so that's kind of a big deal. And the day was focused around talking to scientists and engineers who are putting together this specific satellite, which is going to be designed to measure basically the height of like ice elevation around the Earth. So we've heard a lot of talk in the last 20 or so years about climate change and what is the data behind the disappearance of ice. And so we talked to the guys. We're basically inventing the technology to continue to find that data. So they're going to launch this satellite in about a year, and underneath it is going to be this big system of lasers that are going to pulse these photons to the top of these ice sheets to determine, like, down to the size of, like, a 2-millimeter, a pencil, sort of what the height difference is. And one interesting nugget is they said, you know, if you think of ice in terms of tons, if you're wondering how much ice the Earth is losing every year, and you think of one car being one ton, the Earth is losing 250 billion tons of ice every year, basically 250 billion cars. You can imagine that many cars. That's how much ice they're losing. So they're trying to find more data about sort of why that is. So we toured the whole facility, learned how they're going to put this satellite together, learned all about laser ranging and how they shoot lasers back and forth between satellites and the Earth to measure elevation. And then we kind of came up. It was an incredible day and really interesting that NASA is putting this together.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you don't necessarily think of NASA involved in climate change science just because they're thinking about space. But it does make a lot of sense that this would be something that could be measured by satellite.
Yeah, it is. And you know, Goddard specifically is focused on Earth and space primarily. So a lot of the launch sites that get, you know, a lot of press, like Kennedy Space Center or Johnson Space Center, you know, those are mostly geared towards space travel and space flight. But Goddard actually focuses a lot on, like, looking at the universe and then looking back at Earth. So with the data behind climate change, you know, NASA has a mandate to basically keep all of that updated. And so these guys are working to do that specifically. It's very apolitical, so they're very focused on like the math of it, and you know, these engineers and scientists kind of go through, you know, administrations. They've kind of seen a lot, you know, politically, but they're still working on the same project. So it's also interesting to kind of talk to guys who've been working on literally a specific thing since, you know, 2007.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, when you go through stuff, I mean, is it just, are they showing you the technology? Do you get to put on a flight suit? Do you get to try the helmet on? Are there monkeys there? I have so many questions.
You basically go through the whole facility with the tour guide, and you get to go into a lot of the restricted areas. So you're right outside of, like, for example, something called a clean room. So, you know, like how in the X-Files or some sci-fi movie, they'll have, like, the clean room where they have to wear the doctor's outfits, you know, and the scrubs. So you sort of see the guys working on the satellites in that area because they can't have any sort of dust specifically. There's a lot of mini lectures and mini little tours where these scientists will just kind of pop out of their offices and talk to you for about 20 minutes on literally what they're working on. And then there's a few sort of special surprises throughout the day. So, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope, which you probably heard of from back in the 90s, that was created at Goddard. So the guy that, you know, was a part of that original team popped out and gave us, like, the full tour and the full 411 on the Hubble Space Telescope. And then we got to see the control room where they would actually guide and maneuver the Hubble Space Telescope. And the interesting thing about that is that nobody's in there anymore because it's all done remotely. So thanks to cell phones, there's a group of people who can actually stay updated on the micro moves of the Hubble Space Telescope literally over their cell phone.
Wow.
So you get a lot of these kind of real-time interesting nuggets about how the space program is sort of put together and how these projects are executed. And then you get to ask real questions. You know, these guys have been putting this together for, say, 20 or 30 years.
What are the questions that you ask? I mean, what piqued your interest in a tour? Because I know you Space Camp. I know you want to get in there and you want to jump around and you want to do, like, the old 80s movie about Space Camp. I forgot the name of it. I think it was a rom-com.
It was called Space Camp.
Space Camp,
yeah.
What were some of the questions you have for the staff at Goddard?
You know, one question I had was, you know, how can you put this into perspective? You know, so if they're, say, testing laser photons that are going to be going from the Earth to space, and they're testing it over sort of large areas on land, how can you put that into perspective so, like, regular people can understand it? One thing they said was, you know, if they're testing a laser at a laser ranging facility, they will take a laser and aim it from Baltimore to kind of the equivalent of, like, the Washington Monument, and they can get as precise as hitting a head on a dime.
Wow.
So they have to have some real precision around that. The other thing that's interesting is that some of the materials and equipment does seem like it's kind of like from the 70s and 80s, but in some cases it's on purpose because they don't really need to be upgrading everything. So you do see some of the kind of original wood paneling and some of the original sort of computer consoles, but the technicians haven't needed to update that technology for, like, a specific task. So they haven't, you know, gotten a nice new computer. So it's interesting to see sort of what they focus their time and efforts on as well. Most of the guys are lifelong space enthusiasts. They're really geeked out to work there. I did ask them a couple times, like, you know, how do they sort of see the you know, political world right now? This is obviously a really challenging time. And they said they really try and stay out of it. They try and really focus on their job and stay super positive about the space program. So it's also sort of a way to spend a day with teams of people who are focusing solely on their jobs and really staying out of kind of politics, which is really interesting as well. It's a fun culture. It's a great vibe. I will say we had this dinner. We have these group meals. And at the dinner, the main guy from NASA, the main scientist, took the time to take about 3 minutes to thank the vendor who bought everybody pizza. And, I mean, just having been a part of companies for 15 years, I've never been at an event where somebody's, like, so grateful for people who work for them. It's just, it's real kind of love fest. It's hard to describe, but a really cool culture there.
Well, my last question really just has to do with how many sci-fi pop culture references did you try to get in today with these guys, and were they playing ball? Were you like, it's coming through now, Con? And they're like, dead.
Yeah, they did play ball for sure. I mean, you know, for example, they have their photo wall, and if your photo's missing, they put a photo of R2-D2 instead of your photo. You kind of walk around and there's a million Star Wars references. You're kind of walking through the set of all of your favorite sci-fi movies. And there were a few moments where we were like, this thing looks exactly like the Death Star, right? When they're testing the photon lasers at night at this thing called the laser ranging facility, you see this big sort of photon laser emitter, and it looks exactly like the Death Star. I mean, it's this big, you know, bold green laser that flies right into space up to a satellite. that they get to see it sort of tested, and you're like, how can you guys not quote Star Wars quotes all day? And they're like, we kind of do. They have fun with it, and it's great. They had to. Yeah, exactly. So it's a real fun, you know, opportunity to get in touch with those guys and sort of see what they're up to. And you know, the sort of takeaway, I think, is that there's a lot of these out there, and this satellite will be launching in about a year or so, but I'm going to try and do some more. So I'll keep you posted when the next one comes up.
That's Sandy Marshall. He's at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center just outside of Washington, D.C., getting the 411 on ICESat-2, the satellite that will launch in 2018. Sounds like a dream come true for you, Sandy. Thanks for joining us. Tell us all about it.
I will. Thanks so much, Justin. Have a great night. Good luck next week. Sounds like a great week.
You don't remember the Pioneers, Losers and Clark, Loser and Clark? All right, coming up, Patty Vasquez. It's the end of the week here. We got big plans this weekend, Pete. What are you going to do? You gonna throw down? You going to take that extra hour? I heard Rob in the news. He's like, remember, fall back. So set your alarm before you go to bed. I'm like, go to bed? You got one extra hour to hit the clubs.
When he says that, I say, set a clock. That's what I say. Set a clock.
I always have to say that to myself. I'm like, oh, I got an extra hour to party, which means nothing. Because when it comes to midnight on Saturday night, and then you recognize that, you're like, I'm still tired. It's going to be awesome. I'm going to get 8 hours of sleep tonight. It's going to be great. Yeah. What are you going to do with that extra hour? That's the question.
Right? Yeah.
If you had one extra hour this weekend, what do you do? Where do you invest that hour? I mean, I cleaned up my Halloween decorations.
Yeah,
that's
you're done. I ordered a Christmas tree.
You did?
So maybe put that up.
Would it like a fake one?
Yeah.
Like you're going, what color? You going green or white?
Pink.
Pink? That's classy.
It's our second, it's the second tree.
You got one upstairs, one downstairs?
You got to.
I love it, man. This is a year where this will be the third Christmas we've had together, Christmas season, Pete. And I think we need to suss out more of your Christmas love.
Uh-huh.
Like, I feel like you are Mr. Christmas here at GN. And every year it's always at the last minute that we're like, oh, yeah, I went to 30,000 places. And I've invested thousands of dollars into my Christmas experience. So this year we got to jump on it early, do some more Christmas with Pete kind of segments.
Got it.
Sound good?
Yeah.
All right, Patty Vasquez coming up.